So 14:18 is, now my whole thing went kabooey. 14:18 is, let me tell you what measure that is. Yes, okay. And that one was recommended. And if you see in the right-hand yellow column, that's the vote on the final vote on the recommendation. 14:21 was also recommended. And Lauren, would you put the highlight the cell with the measure name and number? Okay, there. You should be able to see it in the formula bar.
Method of accuracy.
Okay, oh, I see. All right, okay, method of adequacy measurement. And that one was recommended. 1423 is, here, I'll just read them all.
Minimum
SPKT over V for pediatric hemodialysis patients. That was recommended. 1425, measurement of NPCR for pediatric patients was recommended. 1426 was assessment of iron stores. That one did not pass the importance criterion, so that's why I have the no I. That's my little shorthand there. 1431 was measurement of iron stores for pediatric patients. That one did not pass. And then 1428, use of iron therapy when indicated. That one also was not recommended. It did not pass the importance criterion. 1433 was use of iron therapy for pediatric patients. And that one was recommended. 1429.
Avoidance
of iron therapy and iron overload. That one was not recommended. It did not pass the importance criterion. Okay, then we go to 1424. That's monthly hemoglobin measurement for pediatric patients. That one was recommended. Okay, 1430. It's lower limit of hemoglobin for pediatric patients. That one was recommended with condition, and those conditions were exclude sickle cell anemia patients, and the numerator to be the number of patients who were below that level for the 3 months, out of the 3 month study period. Okay, 1454. Was proportion of patients with hypercalcemia, and that one was recommended with condition, and again the condition was for that one to change from average to the percentage of patients above the value for the 3 months, for each of the 3 months. 1427 was adult dialysis patients serum phosphorus greater than 6. That one did not pass the importance criterion and not recommended. And same with 1461, proportion of patients with hypophosphatemia. Same thing, didn't pass importance. Okay,
so we'd just like to provide an opportunity to make some comments on any concerns you have, any concerns about inconsistencies or other issues with the metrics from yesterday before we move on to the new work. Anybody have any comments?
In the interest of time, would it be better if we at the end did this and looked at everything, you know, or maybe offline in a subsequent phone call, given how, it's better, maybe it may be better in the context of looking at all the measures that have been improved to assess what we think.
That's fine. I've been notified that that Bob Wolf and his group wants to ask us to reconsider the recommended change on the anemia, pediatric anemia metric. I think of it maybe it's best if you address it when you do your...
when we have the period for the major developers to make some comments.
So let's do that then. Okay, any other comments? Something you must say? Okay.
Right. Is CMS on the line? Because we'll have that time for CMS too. I know they said that they were going to be able to join us. And what we'll do, Ben, and I guess what we just wanted to check, not so much to rehash things, but if there are any questions that will, you know, that we need to make any clarifications for, so for the review of the rest of your measures, we should do that now. And we will, I think that's a fine idea that we can, you know, look at all the recommendations after they're finished. Also, in terms of any of the recommendations with conditions, the measure developers have an opportunity to make a response to you one way or the other and provide their rationale. So it's not like this is the final take on that. We'll need to see what their response is. And I think, as pointed out, we have a lot to do. So have we heard from CDC? Okay. So I think what we'll do then... Yes?
All right, Tom Dudley, I'm on the line. I just wanted to let you know.
Okay, great.
Renee Henry's here, too.
Who?
Renee Henry from CMS.
Okay, great. Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to finish up. We're going to do fluid management measures from that we didn't get to yesterday, and then we will have then we'll proceed with our agenda for today, which will begin with introductory remarks, our brief introductions by the measure developers and stewards, and then the measures that we were scheduled to do today. We may have to do infection before hospitalization, depending on CDC's availability on the phone. So we'll have a little flexibility there. But shall we just get into it?
So let's move to the measures for fluid weight management. And we'll start with 1432, dietary sodium reduction advice. Myra Kleinfeder, primary reviewer. Are you ready to take it away?
Yes.
Need a minute to kind of jump. Get your mic down, please.
This measure was the dietary sodium reduction advice. The information that's summarized by the staff indicates that it's a process measure, and the requested measure submission information was complete. Testing has not been completed yet, but there's no data to support this performance among ESRD patients, but the general recommendations from both the Institute of Medicine Committee, the SALT Committee in terms of looking at overall reduction in cardiovascular disease to the general population, it's assumed that it corresponds to the ESRD population. This information is part of the dietary instructions for patients. Some of the benefits of improvement in quality: the excessive salt intake stimulates thirst that leads to the fluid excess in patients. And it's almost entirely dependent on the dialysis for providing an important function. And the restriction of the dietary sodium has been widely recognized in recent times as a big public health priority, and it remains a critical part of the management of hypertension in patients overall on dialysis and not on dialysis. So in terms of the summary of the information, I had six reviewers, and that has 7 now. So 1 yes, 4 no's. For the second in terms of acceptability, it's all over the place. We had 2 completely, 2 partially, 2 minimally. In terms of the usability, 1 completely, 2 partially, 2 minimally, and 3 not at all. Feasibility, 3 completely, 2 minimally, and 1 not at all. And in terms of recommendation of this measure, On this one, there are five no's and one yes. And above it has, I guess, one yes and six no's on the more completed one. Five and two, okay. And that's pretty much all.
So what were the issues?
Some of the big issues were it's part of the regular counseling, but there was no evidence. There was minimal evidence in ESRD population in terms of what this outcome would be. We have inference information that it's a good thing to do for hypertension management, but we have no hard data to show where the morbidity mortality reduction is. They cite on page 4 of the summary some studies from 2003-2009 from Tassin, France, showing diligent use of dietary restriction does decrease the amount of fluid gain between sessions, but there's no other long-term outcome data, and that's the big problem that the reviewers had in terms of making this recommendation overall. Any other discussion from other reviewers?
Yeah, Myra, maybe I could add over here. I think there are two ways to look at this. First of all, if you look at the science doesn't have the adequate links. That is, there's no data on performance gap. There's insufficient data linking dietary advice given by the dietitian to actual sodium intake and its consequences, or volume and its consequences. That link is missing. And so there's a problem with this, but I would look at this the other way, and actually Karen had suggested this in her notes, and I think it's very wise for us to consider this, that this is a measure that perhaps is best assessed, dietary advice is best assessed perhaps by patients and not by professionals, and a measure that's designed around patients hearing and understanding of advice is something that would make more sense to me than this measure as it's currently presented.
Jesse.
I agree with all that. The other issue I thought was problematic was within 90 days, that which says to me that every patient within whatever this 90-day period was going to have that specific advice, which made no sense from a practical standpoint.
Okay, other comments by those who reviewed it?
Yes, I was one of the reviewers, and being a patient, I am for it. The reason is, patients, when I started on dialysis, there was, of course, the fluid problem. I learned early on that there was a link between my salt intake and my fluid intake. And that also dictated how well I dialyzed. A lot of the patients today that are starting on dialysis have no idea about that link. And as Dr. Cliver and the physicians say, there's really no scientific. But as a patient, I can tell you I've been there, and it does make a difference. The patients that do not, that come in fluid overloaded, are branded as non-compliant. We worry about phosphorus. We worry about anemia. But we do not emphasize the fluid management. I visit 28 clinics in the San Antonio and the Valley region. I interviewed 14 dietitians about this. Hardly any of them talk about or document salt restriction or salt intake. What they do if someone's overloaded is they give them a sodium sheet that tells them what foods to watch out for. They don't sit down and talk to them and try to explain to them the relationship between the salt and the fluid gain. So although this measure may not be written quite right, I think it's something that we really should consider for the patient. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan?
I think Bobby's exactly right, and I think that a measure that has the ability to measure what dietitians say to patients and patients' assessment of that advice is the measure that I would love to see.
Myra?
Yes,
so how would you, do you want to propose how that would be constructed?
I think that that has to go to the measure developer. I mean, it's not this measure.
So I was one of the ones that voted yes for it. I'm in an area where the average New Orleanian salt intake is 10 to 15 grams of salt a day. And it's not unheard of that I see people coming in with, you know, 8 to 10 kilos of fluid between a two-day session. We make the recommendation, but we need to figure out a better measure to actually capture the data. This, I recommended it. Yes, we have to start with something. There is nothing now. And perhaps over time, develop something that's a little bit more precise to measure what we're trying to get at in terms of acceptance of the advice given by the dietitians.
I was also one of the reviewers, and I agree. It is actually what Myra said is exactly what I was going to say, is I think we need a better measure with more specific standards that are more objectively being able to be measured. I think it's a critical measure that we should look at, but this isn't the right language. It's too vague, and I think needs to go back to the developers for a better language.
For those of us who haven't studied it, how is the numerator collected? Is it just a checkbox on some Crown Web screen or something that it was done? How is the documentation requirement here?
So in terms of the calculation algorithm, it's basically at the 90-day period of the reporting month, it's all patients that are admitted to that facility over that 90-day period who receive dialysis through that 90-day period. And it's basically they have no exclusions, and everyone who's there in that 90-day period is part of the numerator from the way I see it. And the reliability and validity testing has not been completed as of yet.
And the data, but the data that a patient has received instruction is just a check it off.
It's patient education on sodium restriction from Crown Web
from
data
Crown
is all they say. It doesn't specify how it's, what that means.
Thank you.
Is that in Crown Web? Is that collected in Crown Web?
It's not an element that was submitted. It is not historically collected, and that's why testing has not yet been done. So it is a new data element that's in the business requirement.
So is it a data element that gets back to Peter? Is it just a checkbox that says diet? It's a data element that says...
It is a data element.
That just says...
It is a data element that says patient received...
Right.
The specifications. So it says basically there's going to be a data element recording the date of the most recent patient education on sodium restriction. And then there's some comments about formal documentation of dietary advice counseling should be signed by the registered dietitian at the facility. But it's unclear how that relates to the data element. It seems like the data element is going to be just the date. And Helen, you want to make a comment?
I'll make a comment that as a matter of policy over the last year or so, we have for the most part rejected all measures as a matter of course that reflect what a provider says about what a patient learned. That the appropriate approach is you go to the patient to find out, did you get that counseling? Because otherwise, it does just become a checkbox.
I'd like to just comment that just the fact that this is on there is something. You know,
right.
You're going to be asking for that, and that's going to influence behavior to some extent, probably as much as if we had this metric pass, which we see, you know, has these flaws. So, other comments before we get to voting? Bob.
The measure was not intended to be a measure of the information that the patient received. The measure was a process measure of whether advice was given.
And that's good, but you know, one could question whether that needs to be a national voluntary consensus standard. So, okay, other comments?
Just a reminder that this is eligible for time limited. In fact, all of the fluid measures are time limited.
Only time limited? Because they haven't been tested. Okay. So this is eligible only for time-limited endorsement. Okay. So I think we're ready to vote. Do we have, everybody have your Voting tablet.
So we will start with, is this measure important to measure and report? Okay, so we have 5 yeses and 15 noes, so it doesn't pass the importance criteria.
Okay, very good. We'll move to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next in line.
1434.
Sodium profiling practice in hemodialysis. Connie Anderson was asked to review.
This measure is the proportion of patients who are not prescribed sodium profiling in the reporting month. This is a process measure. This measure has not been tested. The numerator is the number of patients in the denominator who were not prescribed sodium profiling in the reporting month. And the denominator is the number of patients in an outpatient dialysis facility undergoing chronic maintenance hemodialysis. There has been no reliability or validity testing. There is no exclusions. The measure, there is no gap analysis or performance. And the measure is, there has been no testing of the measure. In looking at the importance, there were two yeses and three noes in terms of, and I'm having to read it from up there.
Okay. In terms of importance, there was two that said yes and three no. And then for scientific acceptability, spread out, one completely, two partially, two minimally, one not at all, sorry. And then usability, one completely, three minimally, two not at all. And feasibility, feasibility, one completely, two partially, three minimally. And then for recommendation, one yes and five no.
And I think some of the comments were it's uncertain of its widespread use, uncertain if the public can use the information or even if the information is reliable. Sodium restriction is an important but limited data on the use of sodium modeling, whether or not this is even an issue. Also consider hypertonic saline at facilities, and it is susceptible to unintended consequences, for example, increased interdialytic hypotension in a subpopulation of the susceptible patients, but it's not been tested.
Okay, comments from other reviewers. Yes.
Jerry just pointed out to me that although it's in the specifications, this is intended for adults or patients over 18, it's not clear in the measure, in either the numerator or the denominator. But, so...
It says target population 18 and over, but in the exclusion section, it says none.
Yes,
so.
There are none.
That's not really an exclusion if it's defined in the denominator.
The measures are defined in either the numerator's number of patients over the age of 18. So just that in and of itself.
That's something that we could ask them to do.
Right.
That's a minor thing. I mean, I think that's, but yes.
So is your point it should be? Yeah.
I don't think it was intended to, but I was just talking.
Microphone.
That it's clear that nobody thinks that it's that they should be included, because it's not clearly stated in the numerator or denominator.
Is there an assumption then by the those submitting this that sodium profiling is a good thing and that everybody should be on it? Is that I'm not clear what the intent
is. No, the intent's the opposite. There is conjecture and reasonably good hypothesis suggesting that sodium modeling results in increased sodium delivery and therefore increased volume, and we'll talk about this with the next measure as well, consequences of excess sodium transfer into patients. I was one of the reviewers as well. The hypothesis is a very strong one, and I, for one, would love to see more evidence examining this hypothesis, but it's not ready for prime time for a measure as yet. There are no sufficient data that would support that hypothesis.
The hypothesis that this is not good for anyone, is that...
The hypothesis that sodium modeling ends up causing excessive sodium transfer to patients and the bad consequences of that.
Okay. Other comments? Are we ready to vote? Okay. Let's do it.
All right. 1434 and importance to measure and report.
So we have 4 yeses and 16 noes. Again, it does not meet the importance criteria.
Okay, let's move on to 1435, restriction of dialysate sodium. Alan?
Okay, well, this is a measure as described, which is intended to measure the proportion of patients who are prescribed a dialysate sodium concentration of less than 138 milliequivalents per liter for all sessions in the reporting month. The definition with a numerator being the number of patients who were prescribed a dialysate sodium of less than or equal to 138, and the denominator is all patients. And I don't remember, it doesn't say adult or not, but it says all patients in any session month that's being reported. The overall intent here, again, is the hypothesis that when the sodium concentration is greater than some number, and they've picked in this proposed measure 138, that there will be excessive sodium transfer into patients and negative consequences of that. I think a very attractive hypothesis and one that many clinicians are using and thinking about now, but unfortunately the data for the utility of that hypothesis is not present. The developers themselves say that there have been no formal studies on the dialysate sodium concentrations of facilities in the United States, and that disparities for sodium by population group have not been reported in the literature. The measure is really based on the 2006 publication of DOPS that does show some correlation. That's the next measure. I'd like to again quote Karen Pace. For those of you who haven't paid attention to it, did a spectacular job, I think, and I just want to publicly acknowledge that in helping us reviewers point out what some of the potential weaknesses and issues were in the measures. And Karen really nailed this one, because let me just quote, if I may, some of the concerns that she had about this review. Karen, I don't mean to put you on the spot that way, but Karen points out that there was no data on the performance gap in this one, that the developer's summary of the evidence did not identify a specific value associated with outcomes. In other words, why 138? There is evidence that the high sodiums are a problem, lower are not, but no evidence in the literature at all about what's high and what's low and why that particular cutoff. Testing has not been conducted. And so that was the overall sense of this. And Karen, could I ask you to run through the voting on this one? My old eyes don't get up there.
On this one, importance to measure and report, 2 said yes and 4 said no. On scientific acceptability, 1 partially, 3 minimally, 2 not at all. On usability, 3 minimally, 3 not at all. On feasibility, 1 completely, 3 partially, 2 minimally. And on the recommendation, 1 yes, 5 no.
I gotcha. Do any of the other primary reviewers want to add anything to that? I guess my takeaway after reading the reports is that I think this is a really attractive possibility, and again, a hypothesis very worthy of appropriate study, and it wouldn't surprise me one tad if this ends up being important and at the next round turns out to be one we should look at carefully, but I think it's premature.
Okay, any other comments before we vote? Good, let's get to it.
$14.35, importance to measure and report. We have 2 yeses and 18 noes. Again, does not meet the importance criteria.
I ask one question. I'm trying to look through the specifications about the age, the intent of the target population here, and I'm not sure. I just couldn't go through it quickly enough during the conversation.
Okay.
But when we get back to the measure developers with these, I think the issue of the way salt is handled in small children is distinctly different than in adults, and we do use different dialysis baths, and we do, because of blood pressure issues, use different, we may have to use sodium profiling. And I think in growing children, and many of our patients are actually lose salt in their urine. My point is only I would like to get back to them and state if they haven't excluded pediatrics,
right,
that would be an important
this one, which this one also says the target right. population is 18 and older. So that's the group. But we can certainly ask them to put that in also in the denominator statement. Yes.
We will definitely confirm this with the CTAP, but my recollection from being there for much of the deliberations and follow-up was that they were looking specifically at adults, 18 and above. So all of the measures in the group.
All this, okay.
Okay, shall we move on, Karen?
Yes.
Okay. The next metric is 1437, utilization of dialysis duration of 4 hours or longer for patients new to dialysis. Bobby.
Okay. As you read it, the description of the measure, the proportion of patients new to dialysis whose prescribed dialysis session length is at least 240 minutes. Type of measure is a process. Testing, no testing has been done, but testing should be completed within 12 months. No data on performance gap was provided. The summary of the evidence does not provide the study results that suggest that longer treatment time is associated with improved outcomes. The title indicates patients new to dialysis, but the denominator seems to include all patients undergoing chronic maintenance hemodialysis. As you can see from the top, I have importance to measure. There are 3 out of the committee, there were 3 yes and 3 no's, so there was a split. Scientific acceptability. Let me see if I can. Too complete?
Too completely, too partially, and too minimally.
So we're all over the place with that. Usability?
Was too completely, too minimally, too not at all.
And feasibility?
For completely, too partially, and okay. And then the recommendation was two yes, four no of the initial reviewers.
Okay. Some of the comments the reviewers had were shorter dialysis times have been associated with poor outcomes. Increased dialysis times have been associated with improved outcomes, dependent of dose as measured by KT over V. Time on dialysis is very important. More data needed on frequency versus time. By the title, the denominator described is wrong. The denominator described all dialysis patients and not just the new dialysis patients. While it is clear that several outcomes are better when more dialysis is compared with less treatment, and also there is a wide variation in dialysis prescription across dialysis facilities, the specific link to longer dialysis sessions prescribed three times a week has less support. More frequent hemodialysis treatments may improve some outcomes. More removal of solute, urea measured by KT over V, may improve some outcomes, and longer dialysis may improve some outcomes. There is little convincing evidence that a cutoff of 4 hours of treatment provides better outcomes, and particularly little evidence in subsets of patients, small patients, large patients, who may have different metabolic requirements for dialysis. And the last comment, numerator of measure is unclear, incident patients only or prevalent patients.
Thank you. That's excellent. Other reviewers want to comment? I think she said it all. Please go ahead.
I'd like to give my comment again as why I voted yes. This may not be, again, a written measure, written well. I remember when I dialyzed 28 years ago, we all dialyzed the same amount of time, 4 to 5 hours. At a time, there was no 3.5. I felt better. I did better. We all know maybe conceptual in regards to scientific, maybe, you know, things haven't been proven. But I can tell you conceptually and the way I feel and other patients feel, there's a big difference. I'm tired of seeing patients only lasting 3 to 5 years on dialysis. I want patients to live longer, and I think living longer, better quality of life, better outcomes has to do with longer dialysis. Whether it's frequent dialysis, 4 or 5 times, 6 times a week, I just think we're under-dialyzing the patients. Thank you.
Thanks. Alan?
Bobby, I think you're exactly right. My prejudice is that we're under-dialyzing patients. My concern about this particular measure is that I don't think it captures what you're looking for, which is clear evidence that more dialysis doing more. You all know the FHN study that we just looked at recently, in which we really did show nicely for the first time that more frequent treatments, which did indeed include increasing urea clearance, increasing volume removal, and a whole variety of other things, and some increase in time, although each session was shorter, resulted in clear evidence of improvement. This measure really concentrates on time for standard three times a week dialysis. And I'm afraid we don't have clear evidence that increasing the time in that limited 3 times a week is linked to the better outcomes that you're looking for.
I'm sorry, I'd just like to offer a couple of things. I was not one of the primary reviewers, but some conversation, sometimes some important things are talked about outside of this room. And last night we talked a little bit about this is an evolutionary process, not a revolution. We have steps. I actually think the better way for this measure to be written is not so much for new patients, but for all patients. And I think the other piece that's really important, and this is from a layperson, is sometimes, and I wasn't the only one who said this, I wasn't the first person who said this last night, we sacrifice good on the altar of perfect. So I think it's very important to think about the steps we need to move towards for improving patient mortality. So... thank you.
Unfortunately, this is much like the HEMO studies. The thesis behind the HEMO study was to increase time on a 3 times a week in-center typical therapy and compare shorter versus longer times, and there was no difference in mortality. So that's what's even a bit surprising about this to me. It says, here's a hypothesis that we can improve things by supporting more time per session, but a major NIH-funded study showed that's not the case. Can we disagree with that? Or
they didn't look at more than 4 hours, so I'd be careful about making that inference.
Okay.
But there isn't good evidence for 3 times a week.
Right.
But the issue here is people getting less than 4 hours, right? I mean, that this measure is trying to address, that people are getting even less than 4 hours?
Yes.
Is there evidence that people should be getting at least 4 hours?
No.
But is there evidence that more is better?
It depends on how you define more. Again, we just published some data of a randomized controlled trial looking at more as more frequent and clearly showed that that was better. More as in adding 4 or more hours to standard 3 times a week treatment has not been shown to be effective.
So how did 4 hours become the standard?
This is what the proposers of this measure are proposing. There's nothing in the literature that support that.
Let me just complicate a little more, since you're needing an exact number. There's now more data coming out on nocturnal dialysis, which is generally in-center 3 times a week, 6 to 8 hours, and showing improved outcomes. But the difference between 4 hours and 8 hours, stratified, nobody knows where that benefit comes. The data is very, very weak that, as Alan pointed out, 4 hours is good. The data is getting much better that 8 hours is better. But to pick a number in there right now, I think doesn't help anybody.
But is there a number that is bad? I mean, so, you know, like I'm just asking if there's anything comparable to, for example, the hemoglobin, that maybe we don't know the right range or the upper limit, but there seems to be consensus around the less than 10. So is there a less than something hours that is supported?
Not for time. There are data looking at other measures of adequacy that do suggest some minimums, but not for time. Now, again, having said that, if you ask the clinicians around the room, we all do believe that 1 hour of treatment is not adequate, and 2 hours is not adequate, and that 4 or more hours probably is. There are many patients between 3 and 4 now, and little to support that moving above 3 to 5 is going to make a difference.
I want to ask the group about the DOPS data that was presented a couple of months ago, and from multiple countries they showed a correlation between longer dialysis and survival. In Australia, the standard time is 4.5 hours, and that was presented there. But what is the feeling about the validity, if you will, of that data and the power of their studies?
Again, DOPS is a wonderful retrospective review, and the correlations are not just to time, but there are many other correlations as well to better outcomes. So there again, I think that that's an important observation. I think that it's an important hypothesis-generating observation that we need to look at more critically. Here's where Peter's comment before, I think, is appropriate. We similarly had multiple observational studies done back in the late 1990s talking about adequacy of dialysis that spawned the prospective randomized trial that was HEMO, suggesting that in three-hour sessions, more treatment is better, with the measure being KTV rather than time. And that prospective randomized trial failed to show that there was indeed that effect. So I think that the DOPS are very important observational data that needs to generate appropriate hypotheses. Indeed, it's just those that spawned our FHN study. That's where that came from. So I think it's important to look at that.
Just to Lisa. Point out to... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, Lisa, I called your name.
All right, so here's what I'm struggling with, and this is what I struggled with yesterday, is that if we only have performance measures where we have prospective randomized trials and there is unequivocal evidence that this is 100% the right thing to do, we're going to have 40 performance measures across all of medicine, most in cardiovascular medicine. It's just not, you know, for us as patients, for us as payers, for the employers that aren't here in the room today, they're going to demand more. Frankly, they're demanding more, and they're demanding more of us as payers. They're demanding more of the NQF, and you know, Helen can speak to this, or Karen. And it's not going to be acceptable to only have performance measures where the science is 100% unequivocal. I'll tell you, when I was on dialysis, if I, you know, God forbid, had to leave a few minutes early because I had to catch a plane, I had to sign a against medical advice waiver if I dialyzed less than 4 hours. So it really puzzles me. You know, again, I don't care if 4 hours is controversial. Let's say 3.5 hours. If 3.5 hours is controversial, pick a number. Let's say 3 hours. Let's pick a number that is something that is so, like we did with hemoglobin, so non-controversial that it gives us a starting place. But we've got to start somewhere, and it's not, we can't wait for those trials to be done. I'm telling you, this is the purchaser perspective, and this is what we're hearing from our employers. We can't wait, and we're pressuring NQF to get us more measures faster.
My concern with that is that if you use general broad stroke concepts rather than science, and you go back a decade ago or more when it was thought that taking a hemoglobin to normal would be a good thing, you did not help, and you clearly resulted in harm, strokes, and death to patients. So if you're going to have a process, and this was the reason for my questions right out of the chute, what are the criteria for a performance measure? It's different than offering a broad stroke clinical guideline of a should. A CPM is going to be a recommend and a must, and there has to be a science behind that process, or the debacle of the high hemoglobin thing will be revisited, and there are morbidity mortality implications. They are payer implications. There are lots of implications of giving the imprimatur of an NQF-endorsed measure that we have to consider, and that's why criteria of that measure need to be adhered to strictly, rather than, if I was the doctor, I would probably do this at the chair side. That's a big different question than an NQF endorsement. That's one man's opinion.
Alan?
Lisa, I think you're right that we can't wait for 100% certainty. Absolutely right about that. That's not what I'm arguing for, or what I hear others arguing for. We do have a measure that is out there and is now active in terms of adequacy of dialysis. It's based on urea modeling rather than time. So we have a clear measure that says there's a minimum. I do think time may, in the long term, prove to be as effective and maybe even more than urea modeling. We just don't have the evidence that that's the case right now. So I think it's correct that we shouldn't be looking for 100% for something. But we do need the sufficient evidence. And in the one prospective randomized trial that was done looking at time for three-hour standard, three times a week treatments that Peter referenced before, it turned out that increased time did not improve outcomes.
Is there...
I would just point out for Lisa, too, that there is a minimum standard here in KT over V or urea kinetics from the last batch. 247 is that patients have that measurement done. 248, delivered dose that is measured. I don't know. Here's a 249, that the minimum single pool KT over V is greater than or equal to 1.2. So there is an NQS standard for a minimum. And I also wanted to make the comment, when it comes to information about improving dialysis, we have information on how to improve dialysis. And Alan's was a PI of a two-arm study that has shown the way. And it's not by, and the answer is not extending time at least just to 4 hours on a three times a week basis. It's more frequency and more time. There's two models of care that they use in that study that shows the way that improves outcomes. So I would argue that there is science, and NQF, if anything, should be figuring out metrics to, or looking for metrics to push the industry in the right direction. I think there's a great danger of approving this. And the industry is going to say, well, NQF said 4 hours three times a week is enough, and that's the way to go, and it takes us away from creating new solutions. The new solutions have to be individualized dialysis prescription for each patient. If more frequent is better, what fits your lifestyle, what fits your work, what fits your social situation, how many times a week do you want to do it, and how can the dialysis industry and providers accommodate you? That's where I think things need to move, not to say 4 hours per treatment is the right thing. NQF stamp of approval.
And just to expand, Lisa, not only is the issue of giving adequate dialysis important, as we're facing all the bundling aspects now, there's a quality improvement project that only involves three things, one of which is a marker of the adequacy of dialysis. So nobody debates the issue that it is an important thing, but there is a standard out there, and time hasn't met that level of evidence, so we're sticking with the existing standard.
I just wanted to add that I think fluid and weight management in the dialysis unit is a really important problem, and I'm not sure this measure is the way to do it. You know, I can certainly think of a petite patient where 4 hours might be more than adequate, possibly clinically. I can certainly think of a person maybe like me, or, you know, weighs 100 kilos or something, who, you know, might 4 hours wouldn't even be close to being adequate for that. So it's really about individualized care. So I would say, instead of let's just pick a measure because we want a measure, let's think about all these measures in total when we're done. They're all time limited. To me, it sounds like the TEP really was kind of just casting, you know, doing that. What? No, okay, well. Okay, no, I'm not asking a question. I'm sorry. I didn't. Thank you. I'm sorry. I apologize for saying that. And then I think we could come back to the TEP and ask what, or perhaps suggest, ask of the TEP which is the measure they think is the best, or try to address this in some way. If we really want was to have a fluid and weight management. And I guess now that I spoke, I'll ask you to provide a rationale.
So the clinical TEP was charged with trying to develop measures or recommend measures in an area that was of great importance. Okay, I don't think anybody around this table would debate the rates of congestive heart failure in the ESRD population, the rates hospitalization for said consequences to cardiovascular mortality, which the leading members of the TEP, which include the chief medical officers of the two large dialysis organizations and a number of other esteemed senior nephrologists, many of whom were participants in the Boston conference last year, which highlighted the issue of congestive heart failure and cardiomyopathy, felt very strongly that there is data that may not be represented in each of these measures, but if you look in toto at all the references, there is data about hibernating myocardium with rapid ultrafiltration rates, and the issue of time as a potential major effector of total body salt and water. Okay? And they felt there was a starting point that needed to be made. They carefully deliberated the available evidence, and it's all level two. But I don't think anybody debates the issue of inadequate volume control in the dialysis population.
Yeah,
and you all are talking about KP over V and adequacy of small solute clearance, excluding adequacy of sodium clearance. And that's where the TEP was going with it.
I take exception to that. That's not what I'm talking about. Don't characterize what I'm saying, please.
Did I mistake, Alan?
The TEP's intention with this measure had to do with volume control and getting adequate experience with the patient so that care could be individualized. And the TEP's recommendation was that the initial period of identifying the appropriate volume for the patient was a crucial part of developing an appropriate care plan for each patient. They were oriented towards individualized care, and they recommend that the best way to do that is to assure that you have adequate dialysis at the beginning so you can find out what the appropriate fluid level management is. I, again, apologize, and I'll say something which some people laughed at yesterday. I'm a statistician. I don't know all the arguments and all the understanding of the models, but I can at least understand what they were talking about. It certainly sounded important.
I wanted to say, obviously, this is a very important issue, and we're very devoted to doing the best we can for the patient. And I'm not implying that fluid and weight management is not important. The issue is this going to be a measure that's going to be impactful for the patients and serve the patients best?
Yeah. Now, just I just need to say something, if I may, because I don't think we should be characterized as only looking at urea or KPV, and that we're not interested in volume, because it's quite the opposite. I think that it's clear the more we understand about adequacy, that adequacy has to do with time, it has to do with volume control, it has to do with what happens to the left ventricle, it has to do with urea movement, it has to do with larger molecule movement. We're understanding a whole lot more about what's defining adequacy. My comments, and some that I've heard around the table, are focused on the appropriateness of this particular measure and this particular time requirement for which there is no convincing evidence. And I do think we need to continue to be paying more attention to volume and to time and to the other measures other than KTV. I'm just saying when, once again, sometimes it's prime time for measures and sometimes more data has to stand underneath that before you can know what that means. I'm reminded again of the HEMO study, I think very important lesson for all of us.
So how might we move this forward? I think in our heart of hearts, we all tend to think the same thing. We may have some disagreements, Alan and I, with the science and of a given issue. But then how, in Joe's and Bob's, how do we move the field forward as an NQF committee? So I don't see that we're charged to solve the world's problems. If we ran the NIH or whatever, we might have an RFA for this. But I'm not sure how we're going to extricate ourselves from this box, and that's the question.
Well, our job, first of all, is to deal with the measures that are presented to us, and we're not writing measures. But we do have the opportunity and later today, and we want to do this today while we're all together, is to do some brainstorming about where metric development needs to go, or where evidence might be useful to help develop better standards, and to list out areas of care that are not addressed by the current NQF standards. So that's the way we can impact that. We're not the NIH.
Evaluated, and I think they're in the measures evaluation form under 2BC, I think, or 2B2 and 2B3. So as you consider them, if you get to the point of feasibility, these data have been collected.
Okay. Lisa.
I look forward to the discussion later today, and I very much hope we can get to it, because I think that it is critically important that we have some recommendations for the measure developers on where there is an opportunity to improve some of the global assessment of dialysis care. I think we're all quite acutely aware of the issues around mortality and morbidity among end-stage renal disease patients and how we compare to some other nations of the world. I think that there is very good, again, I don't know the dialysis data very well, but, there's certainly very good data within medicine about the importance of underuse measures. And this is an underuse measure. This is measuring whether dialysis is being underused. We might not know that what the right number is. And again, I don't particularly, I'm fine with starting somewhere. Maybe 3 hours is the right, and maybe this whole measure is bad, and maybe there isn't the data. But I've been fairly, without having in-depth reading the data, I've been fairly convinced that we need to, on average, dialyze our patients more than they're getting dialyzed currently. And I think that there's probably some financial incentives that are leading us to under-dialyze our patients, which is, again, the elephant in the room. But a lot of what we do in medicine is based on financial incentives. So I think that is why underuse measures are so critically important to counteract some of those financial incentives.
Lisa, I think we need to be very careful not to go down that path. This is a very sophisticated industry. It is reported on a monthly basis, our measures of dialysis. Every dialysis unit must report them. So to comment that people are under-dialyzed, I just think is incorrect. Absolutely no doubt that there are broader understanding of issues such as hospitalization for volume management. And there's no doubt that many of the things that we've been touching on get to that, sodium restriction, time on dialysis for ultrafiltration, educational aspects, etc. But to say that we doctors consider financial issues and that we're under-dialyzing patients, I just think is really not true and offensive.
I'd like to comment. As a nurse, I truly understand evidence-based and how we practice, but as a patient, I am very frustrated because there isn't a measure in regards to a time. I lost my train of thought when we were talking about the... I don't think that there's, maybe there isn't financial incentive, but there's something wrong if our morbidity and mortality rate is as high as it is for patients, where a patient with diabetes, the average time of life on dialysis is 3 to 5 years. To me, that's uncalled for in 2011 as a patient. How do I educate the patients? And they'll ask me, if I choose hemodialysis, how long will I live? Well, let me tell you, you're a diabetic, maybe 3 to 5 years. No one 28 years ago could tell me how long I'd live as a dialysis patient or how long I'd live as a transplant patient. Okay? I worked with my physician and learned as much as I could, became a nurse, maybe didn't have to do it, but got educated. And I'm here 28, 29 years later. But I think a lot of that's maybe an exception, because a lot of my friends are dying around me. So we are not doing something right. Thank you.
I'd just like to piggyback on that a little bit. I do understand the inadequacies of scientific evidence that we are looking at here, and that we don't fully understand this. But intuitively, it seems to me that when you're talking about what is a continuous body function, replacing it with intermittent treatment, 12 hours a week compared to 24/7 is not the same thing. I don't think it's a coincidence that home patients who tend to have access to, in every way we define, more frequent, longer dialysis, tend to do better, anecdotally speaking. So I am frustrated as well. And while, you know, we look at some of the reasons why that is such an entrenched 12-hour a week, three times a week, you're a Monday, Wednesday, Friday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday person, why that is, it's largely because that's what we've done and because that works in scheduling. And it is often very hard to tell patients that it's a better thing to sit in the chair longer. It really is. And I'm the first one to say that's true. It's tough to tell people that.
Yeah, I think there's a tension in the room that I think clearly everybody in this room is invested in providing the absolute best outcomes for patients. And I think in every corner of this room, not just at the table, I think we're all here for the same purpose. And in listening to this conversation, and again, I am a pediatric nephrologist, and I mostly, my dialysis does pertain to smaller patients. We certainly dialyze patients over 18. I think the concern with understanding we all want to get to the same place, which is better outcomes. If we look at this and we say every new patient, for example, has to have 4 hours, I can tell you I have 18-year-old patients that have cardiomyopathies that simply will not tolerate that. So the question is this the right measure to get to the outcome you want, not do we all want to get to that outcome? And I'm concerned because I can actually see times when this would not serve my patients. And I think that we all agree that there's a minimum adequacy, and there probably needs to be an optimal adequacy. We don't know what that is. But a measure that just increases length for new patients really may have, you know, we keep talking about unintended consequence for patients that simply that's not the right thing for them. Maybe they need to have more frequent dialysis instead of longer dialysis. And I just hope this is the kind of measure that might box people in a corner and end up being more problematic. But clearly hearing it's the intent that we all want to do the same thing, and the frustration that we're not as far along as we should be. And understanding that the measure group, the CTEP that looked at this, was clearly trying to identify measures that were actionable, I think we have to put more thought into this.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
We have Jerry next.
I'm really conflicted over this measure. I'd like to say that I have recently issued standing orders in both of my clinics that every new patient start at 4 hours if they have a graft or fistula, and 4.5 hours if they have a catheter, in part because I want to try to incentivize patients to get their catheters out sooner. But I believe in the concepts behind this, and I think maybe one distinction that we haven't brought out clearly enough is this measure is intended for the incident patient, and we've been for a number of years working on an internal QI project to try to reduce first 90-day mortality rate. So I think it is intended as for the new patient coming in, trying to get them stabilized and find out what they really need, and then try to fine-tune their prescription. And it's much easier to go down on time than it is to go up as far as the patient acceptance. However, I'm swayed by all the comments made on the side having concern about this measure because of the concept of what are we trying to accomplish with a performance measure as opposed to a guideline. I think this would be a great thing for KDOQI to take up as a revised or additional guideline, whereas perhaps it has not reached evidence-based enough to become a performance measure that then takes on a life of its own. And I realize this would be time-limited. So, again, I can see both sides of it. I like the measure, but I'd like to get feedback from Karen about, again, the difference between a performance measure and a guideline, and maybe this will help reduce some of the tension in the room.
KDOQI should have a clinical practice guideline out on hemodialysis by the end of this calendar year, and KDIGO should have an international guideline on dialysis within another probably 18 months after that. So that is coming. It's in the pipeline.
Guidelines on the time?
We haven't even put the work group together yet, but it's really going to be an update of the current KDOQI guidelines. So it'll look at when to initiate dialysis, adequacy of dialysis. And I'll just remind everybody that the original KDOQI discussion about adequacy of dialysis used urea kinetics as only a tiny fraction of that, but it was volume control, adequacy of nutrition, adequacy of blood pressure, phosphorus, anemia, all of those things, not having cramping, not having vomiting on dialysis. That's an adequate dialysis treatment. Just mandating 4 hours, I think, leads us away from really thinking about what is adequate.
Right. And let me focus, because we may be looking at this the wrong way. Individualized care is what we're talking about. There are some people, and most nephrologists now do start 4 hours, but there are some people where it actually can be quite harmful. And maybe a better, and so the availability of more frequent dialysis, both in-center, at home, nocturnal dialysis, in the last 10 years has really skyrocketed. So we're looking at individualized prescribed care. A wiser way of looking at this may be for a minimum, weekly time, or some broader view to address separately the volume issue. And I mean, obviously we all have personalized stories. I joke with people that you haven't lived until you had a bunch of Sicilians on dialysis. My family calling because they're cramping. It's really bad. But I think we need to look at this broadly, because the issue here is volume that in most physicians' minds is separated from adequacy. Some people can get adequate dialysis in 2.5 hours. Years ago, that's a problem we had. But I do think that for us to not accept unintended consequences of this mandate might be short-sighted, and we should look at this in a broader context.
Not to delay this a lot more, but after having this wonderful educational experience today, I realize we're all talking about the same thing. We all want the same thing. It's how to get there. So I think we're really a lot closer than what we think we are. Going to the specific, this measure does not get us there. And that's what we need to look at.
Okay, so are we getting close to being able to vote? I think, as a chair, I'd like to stipulate that everybody here wants the best outcomes for patients. In one way or another, we've all devoted our careers to doing that, we all wish the NIH would have given us millions of dollars 30 years ago, and we could have got this thing done right by now. So I'd like to move to voting if we can. Okay.
Okay, this is on number 1437, importance to measure and report.
We have 6 yes and 14 no, so it does not meet the importance criteria.
Okay, then.
Let's do these.
All right, let's move on then to the next metric, number 1439, utilization of high ultrafiltration rate for fluid removal. Alan.
This is a measure in the spirit that Joe mentioned before of the series that intends to try to address volume for patients on dialysis. And this is one that specifically looks at the rate of ultrafiltration, the rate that fluid is removed from patients during the course of a hemodialysis. The measure itself is, the numerator is the number of patients who did not receive an ultrafiltration rate of greater than or equal to 15 milliliters per kilogram per hour. And the denominator is, again, all patients in that particular time interval. The steward indicated that the measure was not tested. The reliability of weights. Let me just go back again to the rationale where this really comes from. There are now several studies. One that does come from DOPS. That's what I mentioned before. I apologize. I mentioned it with the wrong measure. The DOPS study was done and did show a clear correlation between mortality and rates of ultrafiltration. That is, in people who in whom fluid was removed very quickly, they had a worse outcomes than people who had more gradual removal of fluid. There also were then subsequently several other studies, again, all observational studies, that looked at the effect of rapid ultrafiltration in terms of its effect on the heart. And again, evidence that rapid ultrafiltration rates have potentially negative consequences. Specific issues around this is that, as the developers themselves say, there's a paucity of studies examining long-term outcomes associated with high ultrafiltration rates. The developers say it is uncontroversial that an ultrafiltration rate above 15 milliliters per kilogram per hour is potentially harmful for patients. But that statement is made without any support in the literature. I'm not sure that it's uncontroversial, because there are no data showing, again, that there's any cutoff. And I think it's important to note that most of the data on the high rates of ultrafiltration are in patients who are getting short dialysis. And so the two, that is short dialysis and high ultrafiltration rates, are inexorably confounded. And separating them is not possible based on the data that's available right now. Again, I want to, if I may, Karen, with apologies to you, quote some of the issues that you raised, because, again, I think they're right online. The measure was not tested. The summary of the evidence does not provide the study results that the higher odds of bad outcomes are with this very high level of 15 milliliters per kilogram per hour. So that's not been, you know, sort of the cutoff, and why that was selected is not clear from what the literature shows. And so maybe I can then ask Karen if you could run through for us the feeling of all of the reviewers.
And let me just make a comment about some of these measures and the testing. There was some inconsistent information, I think, on the submission. It was, some of these were checked as not being tested, but then there was some reliability and validity information presented. So this is one where it was checked as not tested, but there was reliability and validity information provided. So let me go to the table, just 1 second. Okay, so the initial reviewers on importance, 3 said yes and 3 said no. on scientific acceptability, two completely, four partially on usability, one completely, one partially, three minimally, one not at all. Feasibility, five completely, one partially, and on recommendation, two yes, four no.
So maybe I can invite others of the primary reviewers to make some comments.
I originally had voted yes, and I'm now voting no, so no comment.
I mean, my concern was what are the gaps in care? How will this impact care? What's the evidence level? Is this a measure that really is going to accomplish what we all want to accomplish?
My concern was that there was no demonstrated gaps in care, and there was no evidence to support this.
Okay, comments from the wider. Alan?
I'm sorry, just one last thing from the viewer, which is that, in my mind, this is, again, one of those very attractive hypotheses. I think that it is likely we are going to be able to show that rapid rates of ultrafiltration is probably not a good thing. We just don't have sufficient evidence to make this a clinical performance measure right now.
Okay, comments from non-reviewers or those who are not assigned to review? Karen?
And I just want to also clarify the comments that we as staff put in that for the reviewers' consideration, for example, questions about the evidence, is questions that occurred to us that you all, knowing the field and the evidence more, perhaps it just wasn't put in the submission form, and you might know that it's there. So just because it's not in the submission form, that's why we ask you, as experts in the area, is there evidence here, or is, you know, are we just missing something in the form?
Okay, Jerry.
Sort of a contrarian position, since we have not yet endorsed any volume-related measures. Would this not be, since it's time-limited, a way of promoting attention to the volume area in practice without overcommitting to a longer period of time?
I'll just mention this particular one actually does have testing information on reliability and validity, or reliability, and then they reported face validity. So we'd need to look at that testing information, but so technically
not available,
it wouldn't
for
be
time
for
limit.
Time limited endorsement.
Then I withdraw my comment.
Is there something about the, well, I'll let you finish your
question. Well, what you were saying doesn't obviate what he was saying, does it? You're saying that maybe we should do one of these to, you know, have a metric related to volume, and you're just saying that it has had some testing. So
I realize that we're charged with looking at these individually, but this is almost the last one in this section, knowing that we've rejected, or not endorsed rather, the others, this would be a way of getting some measure in this arena that could be adjusted, you know, later. And we all, you know, like Myra said, we have patients too that gain 7, 8, 10 kilos, and in addressing those patients, you have to do it through multiple directions of either adding time or talking to them about sodium and pleading with them, you know, so it, all of those things. But this does give a measure where that patient would be highlighted.
Jeffrey?
I'm having a hard time understanding the physiology behind this measure, quite honestly. Neither the plasma volume nor the extracellular fluid volume go up commensurate with body weight if in somebody who's obese. so that the ultrafiltration rate, you know, in terms of plasma volume or ECF volume, it is really not all that weight-based. It is lean body mass weight-based, but not total body weight-based. And, of course, we measure dialysis patients when they're wearing their winter boots and their jacket and their sweater or just their shorts and T-shirt, depending upon the season of the year. So I'm not sure that even having a weight-based ultrafiltration rate makes sense physiologically to me before we even get to think about whether having a rate-based performance measure is the right thing at all. Am I thinking correctly or incorrectly?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, again, the only comment is the batch data are very robust in this regard. If you look at the batch data, they're robust. And the question then has to be, what explains it? And, again, I think there's so much confounding just the ultrafiltration rate that it's impossible to know that. So, I think you raise a good point. It's just that in my heart of hearts, I do think that rapid ultrafiltration rate, when confounded with time the way we've done it, is a problem. But this measure ain't going to help us with that. And Jerry, if I just may quickly, the other thing about just selecting one, I mean, we've got to pick one. Let's get one and let's get it and make it time limited. We haven't talked about the unintended consequences of having your patient or your patient who comes in with a 10-kilo weight gain, and despite increasing dialysis time for that patient, if you restrict ultrafiltration rate to low rates, which is what this would urge us to do, you're going to have patients with far more congestive heart failure and pulmonary edema. So the unintended consequences of this, I think, are substantial.
You're saying that the response won't be to increase the time to achieve dry weight, or the patient won't sit there long enough to achieve dry weight if we limit the ultrafiltration rates. Yeah, Robert. I'm not Robert. I'm Andrew. Sorry.
Whatever.
I'm just looking at a sign.
Yeah, it's hard to tell the difference. It is really disappointing that we got in the end of the volume measures and we don't have a measure, and we're probably not going to we'll see, but it sounds like we won't recommend a measure. But I don't really see how this issue can be addressed without addressing patient self-management a little bit. And, you know, this is true in this issue, this is true in dialysis and true in chronic disease, and the idea that somehow performance measures simply on the part of that look at objective interventions that the physician or the provider makes are not going to be adequate to improve outcomes in dialysis or other kinds of chronic disease. And we don't have good tools for assessing self-management. I mean, I can barely describe it, but I know it when I see it. I see it in four people here, for sure. And so that's going to have to be a different paradigm when you set quality measures in the future, because there's no way to get people to avoid huge volume gains without actively enlisting their participation. And none of these measures sort of get at that.
Okay, other comments? Okay, I guess we're ready to vote then.
This is measure 1439. We need to go back. Oh, no. You're on the wrong one. Okay. 1439, importance to measure and report. What we have to do with the hand. Does everybody think they voted? Okay. All right. We can go ahead.
We have 18 responses, 4 yes and 14 no, so it did not meet the importance criteria.
Okay, and the final metric in this group is 1438, periodic assessment of post-dialysis weight by nephrologist. Myra.
So this measure, basically the discussed in the notes by Karen and Lauren, post-dialysis weight assessment varies by practices widely across dialysis facilities and across the published data. And it's just generally accepted that good clinical practice should include periodic assessments, but a quality measure that requires facilities to document this is likely to encourage better practices across the patient management at these facilities. In terms of the summary of the evidence, the periodic assessment and challenging a patient's post-dialysis weight is a widely practiced clinical approach and for achieving optimal hydration. However, there are some unintended consequences of this, and in general, this approach is designed to slowly achieve euvolemia. One of the things that's also mentioned, the requested measure submission information was complete. The testing, however, has not been completed according to the information submitted here, and it will be done within the next 12 months. There was no data regarding the performance gap, and there was also no data to indicate whether or not the numerator was specified specifically in this. It's assumed that it will be all patients that are at the dialysis unit, but it didn't really say if there were any specific exclusions. In terms of the information by the reviewers, in terms of importance, 5 of the 6 indicated yes. In terms of acceptability, 2 completely, 1 partially, 2 minimally, and 1 not at all, according to this. In terms of usability, 2 completely, 1 partially, 2 minimally, and 1 not at all. In terms of feasibility, 3 completely, 3 partially. In terms of recommendation, 4 yes and 2 no's on this. And from the information from the CMS information submitted, the panelists thought that this actually should be assessed once every 2 weeks, but at least a minimum starting would be once a month, and it should be administered as well after changes in the patient status, such as admissions for heart failure or other cardiovascular-related events. There was a unanimous vote on this assessment, but they also suggested that this measure would be most effectively done as part of a package with blood pressure monitoring, sodium restriction measures, and potentially complemented by some of the new technologies that exist in terms of the inline hemodynamic monitoring, the bioimpedance analysis, or other blood volume monitoring devices. But once again, it's not ready for prime time. It would require more research and a demonstration project or some additional types of funding. But at the minimum, it should stress the importance that an assessment needs to be done periodically. And we know from clinical practice, those of us that are at academic centers, we often get patients that have been at their community nephrology unit and they haven't had a weight change in months. And when you get copies of the flow sheets, you see that they've nowhere near their current dry weight in months. And the reason they came in is because no one's paying attention and just and arbitrarily setting these numbers. So some type of assessment needs to be done, but whether or not this is the proper way and whether or not this is going to be a yes-no selection or whether or not it's going to be an actual data element in terms of how much of a change plus or minus remains to be seen.
Robert?
You know, I think this measure, despite the fact that there's not a lot of data, hits on everything we've just discussed. What we're trying to do is to get clinical nephrologists to pay attention to an issue that many of us feel has not gotten the attention it requires. What this does is it says, doctor or nurse practitioner or PA, we expect some indication from you that you've looked at a dry weight, which of course then translates into, is the time long enough? Should this patient have more frequent dialysis? You know, is my prescription correct? and it actually gets to where we wanted to get with all the other issues. But the, in my mind, the best thing about this, even though it's not perfect, is it can't do any harm. It cannot. The most harm it causes is to the nephrologist who says, Jesus, now I've got to check another box. But the reality is it creates an environment where that nephrologist is having conversations about what we all here want to have the conversation about. So I think this has many, despite the issues that pointed out, I would endorse this.
And I just want to clarify again, this was one where the box was checked, it wasn't tested, but there's actually reliability data, so we could, it would be for regular endorsement.
So this, so when we vote, it will not be for time limited?
Right.
Okay. Jeffrey?
I have a question, actually. I don't quite understand the metric here, and I think it's internally inconsistent. So at one point it says the numerator is the number of patients in the denominator who have documentation of receiving a new post-dialysis weight prescription. And then it later says that it doesn't require a change in the post-dialysis weight prescription. So it basically is saying you as the physician, the rounding nephrologist, must write a note for a new weight every month, regardless of whether they change that weight. So leaving the weight intact would satisfy that. It doesn't say that. What it says is just writing an order.
I think the word new, if that was removed, would fix it. Because new suggests you have to change the number rather than say, I looked at it, I think it should stay the same.
So again, so
let's ask the measure developers about that.
And so one of the points that we brought up during the discussion is that if you require a change in dry weight on a monthly basis, there is a potential unintended consequence. People will change dry weights. Physicians might change dry weights to be in compliance. So a validation or verification of the concurrence rate is a
new assessment. Right.
So this would require that a rounding physician write an order at least once a month specifying the dry weight, whether that's changed or not, from the prior month's dry weight.
Well, the rounding nephrologist would have to validate or verify
Well, the only way that can be captured is to write, and I'm not even sure it can be captured, but is writing a new order capturable by Crown Web? I mean, my practice had been to make rounds, you know, once or twice or sometimes three times a week and say, patient, EDW seems appropriate, or change EDW and make an order to that effect.
So then can't you just check a box off the EMR based on that?
I don't know what the logistics of this is, but that's what it seems like. I want to make sure we understand what's being required, which I think is that the physician write an order with a dry weight every month, whether or not that patient needs a change in dry weight.
I think that the problem with data requirement was being something that transferred by the facility from documents that physicians know for physicians.
So how does that impact validity, reliability of that data? Because now you're saying that it's okay to have a nurse or a dietitian or somebody or a secretary in the dialysis unit comb through the charts of all their patients for a month looking for evidence that the physician assessed dry weight and then make sure that that somehow gets to a form that's interpretable and understandable by Crown Web.
And can I just say, I misspoke. This one does not have reliability and validity testing. I was on the wrong measure. I'm sorry.
So I think the principle may be the same, but I think we need to understand what we're getting ourselves into if we agree that this becomes a performance measure.
So, but just this would be eligible only for a time-limited endorsement for testing. So that may be one of the things that gets tested. You know, how does the data... You know, is it reliable and you know, is the method appropriate? But I'd like to hear from the developers one more time about, I'm confused, totally confused about how you plan to get this data into you know, you're just going to look on Crown Web, and if it's there and it's not really your interest, how it gets entered in the Crown Web or what the process is at the dialysis facility? From your perspective, do you have any, or from the test perspective, how is this information to go from the physician's intent or signature or documentation into Crown Web? Is it the physician's responsibility? Is it up to the local dialysis unit to figure out a method?
So, Peter, on page 142 of the report that he's referencing, it states that the CTAP language proposed, the CTAP then proposed language for the measure that compliance would require, one, a new post-dialysis weight prescription in the reporting month, as well as documentation in the patient chart that the post-dialysis weight assessment was, in fact, carried out by a nephrologist.
Okay. Joseph?
Bob, let me, where the rubber meets the road here. So what we do, your chair side, you look at the dry weight, and then in a comprehensive note of the month, we actually have a box, dry weight reviewed. You check it, yes, and if you change it, you make a note, and you have to change the order. So that's doing the right thing. Then the second question is documentation in the Crown Web. So what is the proposal of how an individual gets from what I've just done as the physician to putting that in the Crown Web?
I can't speak for exactly how Crown Web will be done, but my understanding generally that it may be related to the way claims are done, that there are data collected and it is based upon an assumption that the data are reported accurately, but it is an auditable kind of process, so that if a step were taken to audit that, they could look at your record and say, yes, that's clear evidence that you did do an assessment.
My understanding is that most of the data that's going to Crown Web now is being back submitted largely by the unit proceedings in DCI, with a small number of back facilities that were involved in beta testing, if you will, of phase two testing. So that the dialysis facility has to have a mechanism for capturing that those data about that monthly assessment.
So the onus is
that's true for many other things that are in Crown Web that are not lab results. So
the onus will be upon them to have some clerical person translate physician note into a Crown Web.
I think it's fair to say, though, that the facility will be motivated to get that data, to have a mechanism in place, because this is, if this is a CPM and they're going to be monitored on it, they're going to need to have a method. And as medical director, if you were of a unit, you'd want to make sure there's a process there. Yeah, Barbara.
I'm just going off this technical issue for 1 minute and going back to what Bob said. I actually think, and to what Myra said, we have patients that are dialyzed in outlying units that come in that have not had a reestablishment of an ideal weight in months, and the only reason they're coming in is because they've become hypertensive over a very long period of time and no one's really taken a look at them. So I do think this is a critical issue, that people are not constantly reassessed, you know, as they lose weight, as their weight changes, either and in children, upward or downward. I mean, there's, you know, the other part So this is an adult measure, but certainly the concept of establishment of an ideal weight or a true target weight is critical, and it's constantly changing in patients. So I think, and I don't really think there can be unintended consequences of monitoring patients, and because we're not suggesting an intervention other than we're looking at patients, and hopefully there'll be an appropriate intervention. The technical aspects, which I think are trying, and I understand, having worked with some of the old CPM data, and that abstracting this data might be challenging, because it's time limited. I actually think there's a year to sort of figure out if we can do it, but I don't think that lessens my desire that this may be a good way to monitor patients in an important topic area.
Yes, I'm in disagreement with that.
Let's try to keep it to a couple more comments so we can. I think we're moving towards a consensus here, Alan.
I want to say, I think there are gaps in care in this measure, and I would ask the panel, is there anybody who doesn't think there's a gap in care in this measure? Because we have no data, so we just have to go by our judgment.
Alan?
For anyone who doesn't think there are gaps in care in this measure.
Speak now or forever hold your peace. Okay, Alan.
So, Lisa, this is the example, in my opinion, of a proposed performance measure for which there is not 100% data and not all the links put together, but one that we should adopt.
Barbara and Frederick, regarding your comment, is there any reason this measure should not apply to pediatric patients since it's a monitoring measure?
I guess my only concern is it's difficult in children that are growing, this concept. Nutritionally, we have concerns about growth and weight gain, and they're going to be changing targets. And I guess it's less established. Right,
that's all the more reason to do it, then.
I'm thinking.
It argues for it.
Right, I'm thinking about the nutritional part. No, I actually can't think of a reason why we shouldn't be doing the same thing. And I don't know if Rick can, but it wasn't proposed in that way. But certainly our younger patients absolutely
monitor. Just something we can let them think about a little bit more. Let's give you a little more time. I think that's if you come to that agreement, we could ask that it be extended, I suppose.
Right, and I think with the fact that there isn't... the Crown Web system should pick up again this pediatric patients. It won't come through claims, but that's something they can sort out as because we don't have a Medicare population.
Can I make a proposal to extend this measure to pediatric patients?
Can I just point out that it's actually not written to exclude pediatrics?
I thought the target population, again, just like every other measure, said over 18, even though, is
right.
That true?
It does say, for target population, right. It says adults.
But it's the same thing, it's not in the numerator or denominator.
Right,
it's
in the
same
numerator.
Thing as the other measures.
Right, I know, but the intent was for adults.
Right, that's
and
right.
So
as you pointed out with the...
Right, so...
So if we pass it, we can make a comment back to the developers that we thought it would be appropriate for all age groups.
And can I respond that the committee was, the TEP was comprised of people who were working with adults, and they, I think, thought they framed their experience and their knowledge base in terms of their experience. And
that's fine.
Is this one?
It's fine.
I don't think there was any intent for
Okay.
I'd really be sure Rick feels the same way
fine.
I feel.
I mean, we have the data. It's there. It's recorded. But you want to make sure it's assessed.
Okay, so can we move to voting on this?
So, are there any objections to voting on this with the condition that it also include pediatric patients? Any objections to that? Okay, so when you're doing your voting, keep that in mind. That will be part of the conditions.
I just want to ask a question of clarification. Is this pertaining only to in-center hemodialysis or all hemo and PD patients?
It's not PD.
Is it?
Okay. And I think that's a good question. It does say...
It says outpatient dialysis facilities. It does not include home on this.
The denominator details say denominator includes only in-center hemodialysis patients. So is that appropriate?
Undergoing chronic.
Would it only be in-center?
Only. Does that say in-center? I'm just missing.
2A.8.
Yeah.
Only in-center.
So,
okay, thank you.
I would suggest we leave that. Patients who are home or either hemo or peritoneal, the one-month interval may or may not be appropriate. So I would leave it as it stands.
Okay, are we ready? So this is a time-limited measure.
Time-limited with the condition of adding PEBS and 1438, importance to measure and report. Can I start off?
Down a few people.
Okay. Everyone thinks that they sent their. No. Everybody's there. Okay, let's go ahead and see what the. Okay, we have unanimous. That didn't meet 18 yeses. So remember, do not press it until the clock starts. Okay, so let me ask you this. Did anyone vote against the importance? Did anyone vote no, if they want to say?
Does anybody have a little green light? Maybe somebody would get that,
right?
Right. Right. Okay. So.
Does anybody not have a green light?
Let's.
Extras if anybody's light is out.
We can't vote again on something, but we'll go to let's. I know what we can do. Go back to one of the questions that we missed that we didn't do because. Yes, there. Okay. So on this one, okay. All right, everyone. Oh, wait. No, and we'll, again, wait until the timer starts.
And check your green lights, please. Okay. Everybody will start.
Okay. Okay. All right. Okay. So now we'll go on to scientific acceptability of 1438 and wait until the timer starts. Okay. Everyone voted? Okay, let's stop.
We have 9 completely, 8 partially, and 2 minimally.
Okay. All right. So
how can it be completely if they haven't done any testing at all?
Right.
That's what I...
This, and I should have specified, this would be related to the, primarily to the specifications and the... You know, if there are exclusions, those aspects of those minimal aspects of that are under that criterion.
Yeah, we should say that. Now.
Right. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
Usability. Go ahead. Okay.
It's 9 completely, 9 partially, and 2 minimally.
Okay, and then finally, feasibility. Sorry.
Seven completely, 8 partially, 5 minimally.
Okay, and last then, recommend for endorsement.
With 20 yeses.
Okay. Okay, so what should we do?
Should we have a quick break at this point?
Okay. We'll take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to pick up what our agenda would have been starting today. So we'll start with brief introduction of measures by the measure developers. And then we'll move into probably the infection measures first. Right. If you haven't checked out, to please do that and get back here as quickly as possible. Thank you. Well, it's 10. What time is it now? 10:10. 10:20.
I thought we were going to take up some time.
The other issue, by the way, so the other thing that we did that was the DTEP came up with that, but the CTEP came up after the meeting, and then on the follow-up call, and the council and the what do we measure? What specification?
Is it just ordering? Is it
ordering? Is it reading? Is it inner by inner particular wall thickness? Is it some? Is it exactly?
based on that.
It also influences the measure of patient acceptance of dietary therapy, the effectiveness of dietary therapy, the effectiveness of prescription. It has the most potential to reduce microchronic and it forces people to make more money.
I need to ask you a question. I'm sorry. What was the measure where there was a recommendation to replace the 3-month average with all 3 months in the low cut? I need a number.
Thank you.
Where is that, Alan? That should take a couple of hours to get rid of. I think it's a joke. What does the use mean? Use for whom? For what indication? Was it the same as the adult? Less than 20. What was proposed? Was it 150? That's what I just said. So, okay. So, replacing 100, I thought he was saying the 50 should be replaced. With. Thank you. Okay. You're overly optimistic if you think I'm capable of learning anything right now. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to need to get started again. It looks like most people are back from checking out, so thank you for that. And we are going to now go to consideration of candidate measures, and at this point let the measure developers have a brief introduction of their measures. We have now on the line the group from CDC, and I'd like to invite them to go first, followed by the CMS developers. And then we are going to go into doing right into the infection metrics. We'll do past hospitalization metrics and come back to that later. Okay? So is the CDC on the line?
Yes, we are. Can you hear me?
Say that again. That wasn't very clear.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Try to, yeah. It's coming across a little mumbly, so speak with a great... Enunciation, thank you.
Are you on a speakerphone?
I am. Is this any better?
Yes. And tell us your name.
This is Preeti Patel.
Patel. Okay, please go ahead.
Okay, so good morning, everyone. I'm a medical epidemiologist in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. As most of you know, CDC is a public health agency within the Department of Health and Human Services with responsibility for prevention and surveillance of healthcare-associated infections. CDC has substantial experience measuring healthcare-associated infections and disseminating the data for use, direct use in prevention and quality improvement activities. As all of you know, bloodstream infections cause substantial morbidity and mortality in the hemodialysis patient population. Many of these bloodstream infections are complications of the dialysis vascular access, including central lines. We've seen dramatic reductions in central line-associated bloodstream infections in inpatient populations and have reason to believe that expanding uptake of recommended practices in outpatient hemodialysis centers can similarly reduce the burden of infections in this population. As a result, we have submitted measures that reflect these national dialysis infection prevention priorities. All three of the measures we submitted are currently in use and are collected in the National Healthcare Safety Network, or NHSN, system. NHSN is an extremely stable system used by more than 3,000 U.S. hospitals for healthcare-associated infection reporting and is tied to public reporting mandates. An advantage of the NHSN system is the ability of facilities to view and analyze their data and create comparative reports for rate benchmarking as soon as the data are entered. This feature allows NHSN to function as a quality improvement tool, not solely a mechanism for data collection. Use of the three candidate infection measures that we submitted predates NHSN. The measures have been in use since 1999 and have been collected through NHSN since its inception in 2006, providing us substantial experience with the collection, use, and interpretation of these measures. The measures have been validated, and studies have demonstrated that quality improvement interventions can impact these outcome measures. Currently, approximately 130 dialysis facilities collect and report these measures to NHSN. At least one state has mandated that dialysis centers report to NHSN, and several end-stage renal disease networks have initiated quality improvement projects utilizing the infection measures in NHSN. We anticipate expanded use of these measures through additional QI projects and other efforts. We believe these measures have an important and established track record demonstrating their feasibility and usability. On behalf of CDC, we appreciate the opportunity to submit them for your consideration. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right. How is the CMS group going to CMS proceed?
Evaluation of infection. The difference is in the data collection system, and I don't know if that actually constitutes a different measure or not, because as I heard some discussion before, that once a measure is approved, it can be implemented and reported by a variety of different organizations. However, I would like to point out that the NHSN is currently limited to voluntary facilities who are participating in it. It's very successful with them. I am aware of the fact that there is a data collection burden on facilities right now in terms of learning to deal with new data collection systems through CMS. So I don't know if that's a consideration for this committee or not. I believe that an infection measure is extremely important based upon what our TEP has recommended and what you have heard from the CDC. Can I ask Peter, if this is the time when I should also talk about other measures that the committee will be considering this afternoon, or would that be?
Yes, why would you do that? Including going back to the issue from yesterday? Yeah, you. Well, this is your chance. This will be probably the only chance to really discuss measures to.
Actually, what I mean, you'll have time during the public comment period as well. Which we'll have at the end of the morning and end of the day. But what we wanted this time for was to provide an introduction to the measures that the committee is going to be addressing at the end. If you have any remarks about the hospitalization measures, to introduce those.
Right.
And you can, tell us your question about the measures from yesterday, and we'll make note of that, but we won't discuss that right now, if that's okay.
The SHR, the Standardized Hospitalization Ratio, is a measure which is a primary outcome identified as having high impact along with mortality, and the level of importance is extremely high, not only from the patient perspective in terms of impact upon the patient's outcomes, but also in terms of national health policy, in terms of cost of care. This is something that has direct impact upon our ability to allocate resources for all the essential needs of the ESRD patients. The hospitalization metric is risk-adjusted. This is important. It does account for patient characteristics, patient conditions, including comorbidities. And with extra data flow, it wouldn't surprise me, and I think there's every expectation that that would be brought to this committee for continual improvement and development, but right now it is based upon the data that are available from the claims. It has been reported for many years, so there is a large amount of experience with it. It is very actionable. It has been shown to be related to vascular access practices, to dialysis adequacy practices, and to anemia management practices, all of which are modifiable behaviors on the part of the providers. I have heard some concerns, valid concerns, about the timeliness of the hospitalization. The hospitalization metric does require 9 months to be completely reported, and it's based upon claims, so it takes time for those claims to be finalized. So there is a 9-month lag. I've heard people comment about a 4-year lag, and that's not a lag in the data at all. There is only a 9-month lag in the data. The reason 4 years are used is, for certain kinds of statistics, or has been used, is in order to come up with a stable value, just as you wouldn't use a 1 day's hemoglobin, you would use a rolling average over several values. The hospitalization metric is recommended for 1 year, and that's in order to increase the stability to an appropriate level, and that has been developed over time to be a good, stable metric.
that's all that I have about hospitalization. If further questions do arise during the deliberation of the committee, we would be glad to clarify if we can. I would like to recount my conversation with Alan Kleiger yesterday afternoon, having to do with Measure 1430, the pediatric hemoglobin, where there was a recommendation by this committee to replace the criterion of an average less than 10 with having all three values in a three-month period less than 10. The committee, the TEP, had not considered that. It had considered many, many alternatives. It was a several-day deliberation on the part of the TEP. Experts from around this country who are extremely knowledgeable and very thoughtful about this, and it wasn't just a two-day process that they looked at. This was a multi-week process with many articles reviewed beforehand, thoughtful deliberations, many ideas put forward during the two-day in-person interaction, some of which would be put up as, well, that's maybe a good idea, and after some deliberation, maybe not. In talking with Alan, I think this may be an example of such an idea that seems, well, maybe that's a good idea, but after you think about it, maybe not, to replace the average of 10 with requiring all less than 10. Here's why. One of the problems with the anemia management low-end threshold is it's somewhat difficult to distinguish the non-responsive and, I'll say, untreatable patients. And there are some where you just, whatever you do, you're not going to be able to get that hemoglobin up, from the inadequately treated. By the way, one of the best predictors of being the non-responsive patient is a persistent low value of hemoglobin in the face of continued therapy. So the focus upon patients who are consistently low is likely to focus upon those who are actually untreatable as opposed to those who are undertreated. So that would be the disadvantage of changing it, is it's more likely to focus upon the very people you don't want to focus upon. And you might lose more of the people that we do want to focus upon, those who are undertreated, where their values may be fluctuating but not brought under control as closely as possible. I put that in the context of the deliberations of the TEP because I think that in several of the discussions here, there had been some interesting ideas which the TEP did consider very thoughtfully, and there are reasons why they were not incorporated into the measures. And I can only respectfully submit that the technical expert panels which were assembled, which spent weeks reviewing hundreds of articles, I think should be weighed very heavily in this committee's deliberations. Particularly as you think about, maybe this is a good idea. I love to have great ideas and toss them out, and I expect 80% of them to be shot down.
So I think, Bob, that there'd be an opportunity after we're done with our work, but, you know, there's several steps before there's actual endorsement by the National Quality Forum, including comment periods and so on, to go back and look through the notes, say, oh, yeah, we did look at that when the reason it was rejected was such and such, and bring that back. Right, Karen?
Right. So we appreciate that information, and we can see if we have time at the end of this meeting to have further discussion about that. But the process for this kind of thing anyway is for us to ask for a response from the measure developer in terms of whether that's possible, whether they agree, and the rationale. And then that will be formally then taken into consideration for the final recommendation. So the vote yesterday with that condition is not a final thing anyway, I mean, according to our process, but that.
And regardless of the decision about what to do right now, whether to accept the standard or to take time to change it, part of the reason I wanted to say this is because the test did have very careful, thoughtful deliberations and ideas were put up right here, perhaps to go back as not.
Well, we appreciate the hard work that the work group put in and the expertise that was there, and we respect that. So I think that you'll have a chance to rebut, so to speak, say, well, that's a great idea, it seems like, but here's the problem with it, you know, and I think that we'll have a chance for that interaction.
And that often happens. So it's a back and forth between the committee and the developer. Okay. Anyone from CMS on the line? Do you have any comments, introductory to your measures at this point? Okay.
All right, let's move on then into the consideration of candidate measures for infection. And we'll start with 1477, the National Healthcare Safety Network Intravenous Antibiotic Start Measure. And I have the pleasure of being the primary reviewer.
It's a zip folder called Infection. Got it?
Technology consult for Dr. Burns. Okay. All right, this measure, the brief description, provide a monthly rate of outpatient intravenous antibiotic starts, initiation of a new antibiotic not in use in previous 21 days per 100 patient months within outpatient dialysis unit. The 21-day rule is used to exclude counting antibiotics that are given for the same infection. The numerator and denominator statements are coming up. The numerator, quite simply, the total number of intravenous antibiotics started not in use in previous 21 days in the outpatient unit. The denominator includes patients receiving hemodialysis at the facility. They do say on the first two hemodialysis days of the month, which is a little confusing. I think what they mean is that this is a way to try to capture the total population, and that might be reworded a little better, but I think on further thought I figured out what they meant. I made a lot of notes on this actually right on the form, and when I opened it up this morning, it was gobbledygook. I have no idea why, like a virus attacked it. So let's go to the evaluation by... Huh? Yeah, I got infected. I needed IV antibiotics for my computer.
Peter, before you start...
Yeah.
I should have asked this before, but I wonder if Dr. Patel from the CDC could share the reasoning behind why these three measures are offered separately as opposed to how they are combined in the current NHSN dialysis event module.
Is Dr. Patel?
Yes, I'm online.
Yeah.
So the way in which facilities will enter this data can be combined. So, for example, a patient can have more than one event. They can have a positive blood culture, and obviously they can receive an IV antibiotic at the same time. The way in which we report out the data is separated. So we calculate separate rates for bloodstream infections, for vascular access-associated bloodstream infections, and for IV antibiotic starts. And clearly there will be some overlap between those, but they're also separate measures. So overall, IV antibiotic use is something that is important not just as a measure of infection, but as a measure of antibiotic pressure resulting in antibiotic resistance potentially, and has importance, I think, for facilities when they look at their own burden of antibiotic use. So for that reason, we actually report out the measures separately, even though they're collected together.
Does that answer your concern, Sue?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. When it comes to the section, the next section on scientific, I wanted to mention that there is no reliability testing, and the answer really avoided the topic, and I was I took note of that. And in as to the validity testing, they claim that the results show high accuracy, which was 79%, 88%. Percent at 69% validity. I'm not sure what is high. To me, that doesn't sound that high to validate their that the accuracy was 79 or 69% doesn't to me impress me as high accuracy. That's subjective, I guess. What do others at the table have an opinion about what is high accuracy? Maybe you look at a lot of this. validity testing?
You know, this is a question that came up in the Measure Testing Task Force about how do you look at these testing results. And there really isn't a specific threshold that they felt that was appropriate to identify that would apply to all types of measures, all types of data sources and conditions. You know, some of that relates to even the number of events that you might be expecting in terms of doing appropriate reliability and validity testing. So we do ask for, as you see, the submitter to talk about those results in the context of norms for the particular test or the context. So I don't know if Dr. Patel has anything to say. You know, since CDC does a lot of data collection, might be able to put it more in perspective for us in relationship to their data. Dr. Patel, do you have any comments about the validity results or the testing results?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I can say, I don't have a good sense of what would be considered the norms for these tests. You know, the fact that we actually did do a validation study, I think, is important. And we do actually perform data checks to the extent possible on the data. So there's a lot of this informal data checking that goes on where we look at the data, and if we see something that looks out of line, for example, we've had instances where facilities have reported very few bloodstream infections, but they have a very high IV antibiotic usage, that would be a prompt for us to actually call up the facility and say, what's going on here? Are you actually capturing all of the data? So that's a very informal way of doing it, and unfortunately I don't have any better way to quantify for you the accuracy of this aside from saying that we do look at the data.
Okay, thank you. And I'm sorry. Well, I'm still doing my thing. Should I
be allowed to? I just want to ask a question of her, because
okay,
is there a difference in reporting between those with catheters versus grafts versus fistula? And I couldn't. That was just a question.
The reporting is not different. The report would come in the same way. We collect information on whether the patient who receives, in this case, an IV, excuse me, an IV antibiotic has a fistula, graft, or catheter. So we collect their vascular access type, and then during the analysis, we stratify both the numerator and the denominator by vascular access type. So we would report a rate of IV antibiotic starts stratified by each vascular access type.
Right, I should have explained that. This measure was intended to be stratified. You can look at the whole thing or you can look at it by vascular access type. Regarding the 2F, which is identification of meaningful differences in performance, while this was not answered sufficiently, and it says, the answer basically says this could be done, but we aren't doing it or reporting it to you. So they haven't shown us that they can show meaningful differences in performance. You know, with a lot of these measures in infection, the ones I looked at a lot, and we haven't talked a lot about disparities in care, but I don't know why disparities in care can't be addressed. It's something that is asked on the evaluation, and we know that there are disparities in care, at least in vascular access, and probably vascular access infection, and I believe there's some data on that, and just as across the board on all the infection measures, nobody really addresses that, and it could wouldn't have taken that much time to look up the data and say, oh, there is a difference, and this could be applied in such studies. When it comes to the feasibility, well, usability was not formally tested, but I think this should be understandable by the public, and I don't have a big argument that it's probably usable just on its face. Feasibility, some data will be processed like this. Other data, they start the sentence with other data, so it's very confusing what they're referring to. Also under feasibility is that the data collection doesn't start out electronic, and the plan for electronic data capture is quite vague. So my recommendation was that the importance seems clear, but the measure has not been adequately tested to receive full endorsement, in my view. would consider yes if time limited, but cannot recommend endorsement at this point in development. Let's look at what the other reviewers said. Do we have it up there? So in terms of importance, we had five of six reviewers said it did meet the importance criteria. Under scientific acceptability, partially four, minimally two. Under usability, complete two, partially three, not at all one. And under feasibility, we have two complete, two partial, one minimally, and one not at all. And under recommendations, we have three no's, two yeses, and one abstention. Was that, who's that? Jerry, did you want to? Yeah. You would have voted no?
There are a couple of kind of technical issues. One is that it collects data on patients who have been treated in the unit on days one and two of the month. Oftentimes, incident patients come in, obviously, on other days, and they have a very high incidence of catheters and therefore a higher rate of infection. So those patients are going to be missed for at least 2 to 3 weeks on average. I think you're missing a significant high-risk subgroup, limiting those 2 days. And then it also referred to the months under surveillance, implying that not all months are under surveillance. My third, and that can be clarified, but my third issue is the data collection form is something that's not commonly used in most dialysis facilities other than the ones that have been, it's been field tested on. And given all the expanded data collection through Crown Web that we're going to be faced with, this is yet another form that would be somewhat of a burden. So those are my comments.
Thank you. Other reviewers?
Is it possible to clarify that point?
Oh, go ahead.
So for the first point, the only thing that's collected on the first 2 days of the month is the denominator. So what we found is that the denominator doesn't actually change all of that much during the course of the month. So if you capture it at a snapshot in time, it's fairly representative of what's happening over the course of the month. The numerator is captured for every patient throughout the month. The denominator is simply simplified to make it easier to capture that information. So rather than having to actually count patient days every day of the month, they're really just taking a point prevalence on the first 2 days of the month. And in our experiences, what we've seen is that that's fairly representative. Despite the fact that their patients were coming and going, the overall numbers remain fairly stable over time.
Okay, so to rephrase that, all infections are picked up. Even a patient that's not in the denominator would still be picked up if they get an infection during that month.
Correct.
Correct, okay. All right, I'd just like to remind the developers that unless you specifically ask the question, you really can't respond to the comments by the committee. I think you were sort of asked a question there, so we'll let you get away with it. Okay. Other reviewers. Sue was one, and you were one of the contra opinions about it. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, in favor of this is the existing database and history and data flow from a number of facilities already, as well as the denominator simplification, which is really important in data burden for facilities collecting the data. The reason that I voted against is because I, in principle, believe that the focus on measurement exceeds what is productive in our country. And with the continuing exponentially increasing regulatory mandates for data, specifically infection data, what I am seeing in my community is a diversion of very limited expert resources away from preventing infections,
towards sitting in front of the computer and banging out reports, and that's the extent of the job, as well as a mass exodus of experienced people because it's become a job of reporting and data collection. And I think it's even worse in dialysis centers where there are no dedicated infection preventionists, and these staff have to do so many different things. I think it's really important to consider the burden when you're, even though this is not an organization that mandates collection of data, absolutely, that's what happens. When you endorse measures, that's what happens. That's what's happening in every single state. So I voted against, sorry, in a long way around of saying I voted in favor of one of the three NHSN measures as what I felt was most representative of infection in this population and limiting it to one.
Okay, thank you. Joseph?
Yeah, I wanted to expand on that a little bit. I think it's one thing to have a quality improvement activity in a single dialysis facility for that facility to look at their antibiotic utilization and to modify their behavior over time, to determine if perhaps we're giving antibiotics indiscriminately. Perhaps that is resulting in resistant organisms, resistant bacterial infections in our patients, and that's detrimental to patient care. I applaud the work the CDC is doing with the facilities, and I applaud the facilities who are volunteering to participate in this activity, which is extremely important. However, I think it's a completely different thing now to start comparing dialysis facilities based on their antibiotic utilization rate, because it's a completely different thing. Suppose your unit has a lot of catheters, you're going to have a completely different rate. Suppose you have a different patient population, you might have a completely different rate. We have to be very, very, very careful about discouraging intravenous antibiotic use in dialysis facilities, which could have unintended consequences that we don't understand. There are going to be financial disincentives for dialysis facilities to provide intravenous antibiotics for patients in the bundling era. There are many in health policy who are concerned about that and the implications of what that could mean. So for all those reasons, I'm very, very concerned about this measure.
I've tried to look at this. It looks to me like this is the target population is all patients. So this is not an adult measure. And I'm concerned about the high use of catheter rates in pediatric patients and a very, frankly, pretty fragile and vulnerable and children that have complex disorders may be related to HIV or other underlying illnesses. And I, even trying to stratify, I am concerned about unintended consequences of not appropriately using antibiotics. Although I am also concerned about overuse, I think they're, I mean, I agree with Joseph's point. I am concerned about it. And I can tell you that there are reasons for the high rates of catheters in pediatric patients. Some are warranted or reasonable. We go to transplant much faster in children than in adults often, so we don't want to use up an access we may need later. We still don't do a good enough job, and there are issues, and we do need to have much better access. But we've looked at the use of catheters. It's extraordinarily high in children for some good reasons and some bad reasons, but I'm just afraid this measure is going to...
Right.
I'm just saying, so this particular measure is going to, in the long run, I think, be problematic.
Okay.
I guess my concern is unintended consequences also, either not giving antibiotics empirically while they're appropriate or telling the patients, well, you need to go to the emergency room to get your antibiotics,
right.
And these patients will start showing up in emergency rooms or oral antibiotics will be used inappropriately. So I think it's missing the mark for that reason.
Okay, any other comments before we vote? Alan?
Just one quick one. I think as we look at all of these measures, we're compelled to remember that infections have become clearly one of the most important adverse events that cause premature death and other consequences, so that very much aware of how we need to look at each of these measures appropriately. But I would urge us, we're looking at a whole series now, and Sue made a comment before, a question that I think is particularly critical, which is, can we help to construct an appropriate comprehensive measure that doesn't offer a large burden and yet really does capture the need to understand, report, and make public infection rates, particularly for patients who have long-standing catheters.
Okay. Are we ready to vote? Okay.
This is measure 1477, and we're starting with importance to measure and report. We have 12 yeses and 8 noes. Okay. All right, so we'll move on to scientific acceptability of measure properties. It didn't start. Two completely, 12 partially, and 6 minimally. All right, usability. One completely, 12 partially, and 7 minimally. Feasibility. Nine partially and 11 minimally. Okay, and finally, whether you recommend the measure. Two yes and 18 no.
Okay, thank you. Moving on to 1460, NHSN bloodstream infection measure. Sue Barnes, primary reviewer.
I want to say just a couple of words in addition to what was said before about kind of generally about this category of metrics. And I want to reassure the patients in the room that although a lot of the measures have been voted down, it's my experience within my discipline of infection prevention that measurement is, one, important, but also not the only aspect of or component of performance improvement projects. As a matter of fact, where there is evidence, it's arguably the least important component of performance improvement projects. So I think that when we're looking to change practice, maybe we need to also look really robustly at the existing clinical guidelines, practice guidelines, products, and changing practice through those avenues instead. I would also just put in a word of concern, or maybe a suggested area of focus, is if any of these NHSN measures are accepted and approved, which I think this one will be personally, but that
subtle yet understated,
that there be work done between Crown Web and NHSN in order to interface and build a health information exchange process electronically, so in order to reduce the data burden on ESRD facilities. So, with that said, for measure 1460, which is the number of health of hemodialysis outpatients with positive blood cultures per 100 hemodialysis patient months, it just, in summary,
preliminary evaluations that I received showed 4 of 6 evaluators recommending this measure, some with suggested modifications. The main arguments in favor of accepting this measure is that it, and this is very important, I think, it's extensively tested and it is already used in numerous states. The NHSN database is well established. And in Colorado, it currently, there is a legislative mandate for reporting into NHSN by dialysis facilities on bloodstream infection rates. And that's just the beginning. That will be expanding. There's no doubt about that. The gold standard for infection reporting in every state is NHSN. So we do remember, with an eye towards not adding additional data burden to ESRD facilities, I think it's imperative that if an infection measure is selected, that NHSN is the repository or the source for that data. But there, again, needs to be work to interface, build the interface between Crown Web and NHSN. Areas of concern on this where there were suggested modifications include that there was questioning regarding the 21-day time frame where if a exclusion of repeat cultures, and the question raised, why is it 21 days? And then someone also had a concern that it's not risk-adjusted except for access type, but I would just comment there that in catheters are the single, or access, temporary access is the single greatest risk factor for bloodstream infections in this population. Another concern was that it needs to be continuous versus discontinuous, that it, including patients only on the first 2 working days of the month is problematic, as we've already heard, although we also heard the argument in favor of a simplified denominator, which I think is also very important when you're considering data burden. Blood contaminants are not excluded. The data source form is not standard, where we talked about the need for interface with Crown Web. And using patient year versus patient months, although within the measure summary, NHSN shows how it's very easy to convert the patient months to patient years and also to patient days with a simple mathematic calculation. I think it's important to mention also that this would permit, NHSN permits facilities to view and analyze their own data. They have a history that shows that this measure has been helpful in identifying bloodstream infection outbreaks and also stimulating performance improvement efforts which have resulted in reduced bloodstream infection rates. That's all I have. Thanks.
Ruben. A question more on the process. Maybe somebody, if I remember numerator, it did say that admission to the hospital first day positive blood cultures. How is that data gathered? I mean, how do we?
So there are three separate measures in the standard NHSN dialysis event module. This measure includes only one of those three. So it's just the blood positive blood cultures as the numerator. There's no hospitalization in the numerator for this measure.
But in the definition, if you have positive blood cultures the first day you get hospitalized, that counts in your numerator. I just want to find out, how do we get that data?
Dr. Patel, can you comment?
Sure. So this is kind of the reverse of how we look at hospital-acquired infections. So if a patient, for example, acquires an infection in what we would consider as a community or outpatient hemodialysis setting, you know, it's possible that they may not present to their dialysis facility. It's possible they may present to an emergency room or a hospital, and that's where they have a blood culture done and are diagnosed and potentially admitted to the hospital. So although it is sometimes a challenge to get that information, essentially we rely upon the outpatient dialysis facility to find out what happened to that patient when they were admitted to the hospital, and if they were admitted for a bloodstream infection, that would also be reported. So if that was the admitting diagnosis, that would be reported as a positive blood culture event.
So there really isn't a good method for getting that. It's like a hope and a prayer that someone will go back in the database and or put it on the form, it sounds like. Jeff?
I mean, this sounds like a huge logistical problem to me. I mean, and there's parts of it that are unclear. So what does it actually a day mean? So is it within a day of a hospital admission? I don't know whether that's 24 hours or just a calendar day, which is going to cause some confusion, I think, in collecting data. But to expect that a dialysis unit, either an inpatient dialysis unit or an outpatient dialysis unit, has the wherewithal or even any reason to collect this data accurately and make sure it gets back to the dialysis unit. And we're also mixing a whole bunch of stuff here. So we're mixing a positive blood culture due to pneumonia, a positive blood culture due to a diabetic foot ulcer or a urinary tract infection that has absolutely nothing to do with anything that the dialysis unit has any responsibility for or impact on. It's just people show up for all kinds of different reasons with infections. If the issue here is catheters, then let's focus on catheters. You know, it's not to say that a microbiologic performance measure might not have some value.
Sue, would you like to respond to this? Let Sue give you tell us what you think.
Well, actually, the next measure is this exact measure, except for it specifies that it must be access-related, vascular access-related. The reason I voted in favor of the blood culture only, although what you state is certainly the case, when we're doing surveillance for healthcare-associated infections, to me, it's important to look at the larger picture. So we're going to be able to trend over time where there are issues and where interventions are necessary. It's not perfect unless you do 100% record review, very detailed record review, which is never going to happen in any place, in any facility. You're not going to have a completely accurate report. But I think what this will give you is a tool to support performance improvement. And I believe that is the whole point of it. So it's not perfect, but when compared to the other one, which we'll speak to next, there's a lot more work on the part of the ESRD facilities to determine whether it's access-related or not. There's less data burden, in my opinion, with this one, and that's why I voted in favor of this one.
Joe?
So, speaking to that issue of data burden, particularly the common admission to the hospital and the one-day positive blood culture, that will take extra effort on behalf of the dialysis unit to collect that data. The unintended consequence is if you want to look better, don't ask your employees to expend the extra effort, and because all you can do is actually hurt yourself, if you think about it. If you work hard to get all the positive blood cultures, my unit will look worse off than Jeff's unit, who just kind of ignores the situation. And I think that's
other way around.
Or whatever.
My unit would look worse.
Okay, Myra's next.
One other thing that we're going to burden the dialysis units with is determining whether it's an inpatient status admission versus an outpatient status admission. We have time and time again where patients come to the hospital for a one-day stay. Somebody sees an access, they can't get peripheral access, and they use our catheter that's now infected. That's not counted as a hospital-associated infection because they maintain an outpatient status. So we need to look at one of these other, I guess, counting metrics that we're going to create a burden for the dialysis units if we move forward with this measure.
Robert?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with Myra. This can be gamed way too easily, and although I think we're all talking about the same thing, and Sue, I commend you for really being concise in how you view this, infections are high in dialysis units. They're higher in units that have too many catheters. I think what we're talking about here is decreasing infection rates, which tend to be linked to catheters. So creating a measure that can be gamed causes create problems, add a logistical burden to overstress staff, I think is the wrong approach. So I would have difficulty supporting this as written.
Can you identify a better approach to get at it? Oh, Alan has one.
Yes, I endorse Jeff's approach.
What's that?
to do vascular access rebates.
Yeah, specifically. Right. I just ratified the vascular access.
Okay,
that's actually more of a burden.
That's the next measure. So we can just say we approve the next measure and then go on from there?
Can I ask a question, Sue? This is currently part of NHSN. So it's out there. It's being reported. Whether it's an NQF-approved measure or not, it's out there.
Yes.
And the states are going to – Colorado's already mandated it. Other states will soon mandate it. I'm assuming that others will be following soon.
The dialysis event module, which includes three metrics, one of which is this one, and the other two are hospitalization and IV antibiotics.
So whether we approve this or not, it's out there, and it's going to be something that the facilities will be reporting.
Let me just confirm that with Dr. Patel. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, these are all currently in part of NHSN and being collected as part of Colorado's mandate.
In Colorado.
And I would bet that others will be following very closely behind Colorado.
They absolutely will. Yes, that's our experience in the rest of the community relative to healthcare-associated infection reporting.
So I would argue to not approve it because of data burden is a not valid argument given that it will be reported anyways.
It's currently reported only in one state, so I don't know that we can jump and state that the other states will come in line. I want to get back maybe, and I don't want to speak for Jeff, and focus on the problems that we know. Stratification of accesses in facilities, which is already being monitored, and relating that to positive blood cultures or antibiotics or whatever other matrices of infection gets more to what we're trying to prevent than positive blood cultures in a diverse population that has multiple reasons for blood cultures. But I want to be very sensitive, again, to what Myra pointed out. Many of these patients show up in an emergency room with sepsis, with a catheter, didn't come to the dialysis unit. If this becomes an issue of who's taking ownership of that infection, I can guarantee you that a nephrologist is going to say, you're admitted. The hospital is going to say, no, you're not. We're going to create an environment that really is not where we want to go.
And I know this flies in the face of what currently exists in terms of politics between facilities, but I hope that we're moving more towards a continuum of care philosophy as opposed to this is my facility and this is your facility, and the whole purpose of these performance metrics is to improve care regardless of where the adverse event occurs.
Yeah, let me just add, because obviously we're moving from a bundled dialysis situation to an ACO model, you know, theoretically, January 1st, 2012. Much of what we just explained hopefully will be repaired and go away. The situation that Myra points to is artificial, is predicated on a lot of silly things, but it's the reality today.
But I'm sorry, just one quick clarifying question. If they show up in the ER with sepsis, it's going to be a POA, and so the hospital won't be dinged for it. It's going to be an outpatient acquired infection.
That's right.
Again, just returning to burden and the logistics of this, I mean, people show up in the emergency room. They may not have been to dialysis for days. The blood culture is drawn on an admission day. The results are known two or three or reported out two or three, four days later. We have patients from our dialysis facilities who may end up in any number of hospitals throughout the greater Philadelphia area in potentially three states. And to expect that a dialysis unit is going to call on each hospital day until they get confirmation that there's no positive blood cultures after they figured out where the patient went in the first place, it's just a burden that is just unrealistic without some support for this. It's unrealistic to expect a dialysis unit can or should be asked to do this.
I don't think the measure proposes that level of surveillance anywhere in there. It says hospital, yeah, that you count those, but it doesn't say how you count those. And it's the same kind of thing that applies to post-discharge hospital acquired infections. You know, there's a wide variation in how comprehensive that is, depending on the resources they have to put towards that. No, I don't see it saying anywhere that you have to call every hospital to find those dates. What I think will happen is that most likely there'll be an underreporting of positive cultures that occur in the hospital setting. And again, we're looking at casting a wide net
a large net. We're looking at the bigger picture. We're looking at, we're not going to, it's not perfect. It's not going to catch every infection. It's not going to catch every infection perfectly. It doesn't need to. This is for performance improvement.
The other thing I would like to sort of put out there is, in terms of the catheter-related or the access-related measure that we're going to review in a second, which I think is probably a better measure from a dialysis perspective, I would think we would want both so that you can compare the two and have a very clear idea of the infections in the population as a whole, and then what percentage of them are catheter-related, so that we have an understanding of what the opportunity is. And having the denominator, which we're only going to get through this measure, is a much better measure, I think, than just having the catheter-related by itself.
Alan?
In a world of infinite resources, I would agree with you. I think that it would be a much more richer way to examine the question. I'm still concerned about focusing our attention on the right places so that we leave resources for volume, for blood pressure, for all the things that we're talking about in the wider sense. And here's where I, again, say I think that Jeff's idea is the right one. We should focus on infection rates, antibiotic use in relation to catheters.
There is a greater data burden, actually, for that measure, though, because someone's got to make a somewhat subjective decision, you know.
I'm here.
For both?
You've got to figure.
That's what Lisa's arguing.
I'm saying that to know, you need to know the world of septicemia, of positive blood cultures, and then of those, you need to say which ones are access-related. So I don't even understand how you can have the access-related blood cultures without knowing first the total positive blood cultures. I don't see how you can have the other measure without having this measure first.
Having your denominator be those with catheters.
But that's not the other measure.
I just want to make a couple points here. One is that the measure we're talking about, although it's all bloodstream infections, it is stratified by type of vascular access. The difference is for the next one is that someone then makes a judgment whether they think that infection was primarily related to the vascular access. But I would just ask and ask our patients here, it seems that and it seems also from a clinical standpoint, any bloodstream infection is of importance and is an issue for both patients and providers. So why you wouldn't want a more global bloodstream infection measure, that's, I guess, my question.
Ruben?
Again, you know, going back to what has been said, and I think Jeff summarized it very well, I have a worry about data collection on this. And we're going to discuss the same thing on the next measure. It's the same thing. This first hospitalization day comes up again. And, you know, I think we either ask the owners of the measure, would they consider dropping that, or are we going to have the same discussion later on?
Maybe could we ask Dr. Patel to address that one issue around hospital day? Because I don't really perceive that to be a huge showstopper for either measure, but would appreciate her expert response on that.
Right, and also they've reported some validity data, so if she has any specifics about validity of that particular, around that particular issue as well.
Dr. Patel?
What I would like to bring to people's attention is that, is reflective of what some folks have said already, is that what we're trying to do is capture the entire picture of infections that happen in the community setting in this population. So what we found in most instances, there are certainly challenges in getting this information at times. We don't expect facilities to call hospitals on a daily basis to try to get this information, but the reality is that the reason patients are admitted to hospitals is important for their clinical care. So when a patient comes back to the unit from the hospital, I think it's really important, and I think most clinicians would agree, it's important to know why they were admitted to the hospital. Why they were admitted to the hospital, were they diagnosed with a bloodstream infection? Did they have some change to their vascular access? And were they started on IV antibiotics that need to be continued in the outpatient setting? So a lot of that information is information that is routinely pursued for clinical care reasons that are completely separate from the surveillance activity. So what we envision is that most of this is information that should be captured as part of that process anyway, as part of just the routine taking care of the patient. To address the issue of gaining the numbers, I think we're more we're concerned about that, but we're also concerned that if you exclude this portion, if you say we're only going to count blood cultures that are done in the outpatient unit, you can pretty much be guaranteed that that will be gained, because blood cultures can be done in so many other places. And it's easy for facilities to send their patients elsewhere and have blood cultures done there. So those are our two concerns. And to address the question about validity testing, I don't recall that we specifically looked at this aspect in terms of how many of the blood cultures were captured that were done during an admission, for example, because we don't actually make a distinction. When the facility reports that information to us, we don't know whether the blood culture was done in the outpatient unit or elsewhere. But that's something that we can try to look at in the future.
Okay, so to summarize this portion of the discussion, I would say data collection will not be perfect, and data collection does not have to be perfect.
Absolutely.
All right.
Not for performance improvement.
Right.
For publication, for research, but this is neither. This is performance improvement. It does not need to be perfect.
Okay, so.
NQF endorsement is for measures for both public reporting and quality improvement.
And for neither does it.
For neither does it have to be perfect. Is it ever perfect? Ellen.
One very minor point. I just want to confirm with CDC that this measure is, in fact, fully harmonized with our current bloodstream infection measure for hospitals. That would be a direct question for you, Dr. Patel.
Dr. Patel, did you hear the question?
It's not, actually, and Dr. Patel can add on to this, but this is a different setting. It's a different measure. It can be, you can easily convert the denominator for this metric to be one per 1,000 patient days, which is what it is in the hospital. Dr. Patel, would you add to that?
Right, so it's not captured the exact same way. The burden of data capture has been decreased substantially because we realize this is being primarily done in outpatient settings. So we don't have as rigorous a case definition that needs to be applied. We just simply collect, primarily very objective information and try to build the case definition based on that. And then, of course, the timing is considered to be sort of the inverse. So, you know, within two hospital days or later of a hospital admission is considered hospital acquired, and then we try to capture the community onset side.
I just want to also point out that at least currently, and I don't know what it is on the dialysis side, but there are 22 states that have already mandated use of an HSN for HAIs, which has been the reason that most of the HAI measures going through our process at least have been based on an HSN. So I do think there's, even if it's not exactly the same, because it can't possibly be given the difference in setting, I think there's an important consistency issue there. And I would hope that, again, we're looking at these measures one by one, but I hope at the end of this, you know, it might be helpful at some point just to take a look at the overall set of infection measures here, perhaps prioritize and figure out how to align what's being done in Crown Red with what's happening in HSN, because the idea of doing both doesn't make sense, I think, as Sue pointed out.
I completely agree, and this is already in the NHSN database being collected by more than 100 facilities, mandated in at least one state, and it looks like, you know, that will be expanded based on our experience with other HAI.
Has anybody in those states where this is in place done anything to estimate the reliability or the accuracy of the data that's being collected to know how much it actually accounts for?
Dr. Patel?
I didn't hear the last part of that question. How much did it count?
The question I'm asking is, in the states in which this is mandated, what efforts have been made to confirm that all the energy that's expended to collect the data generates useful, or at least generates accurate and reliable data? In other words, are you capturing 20% of the actual bloodstream infections, 80%, 90%, and do you have an estimate of what is the work effort that's involved in generating that or in collecting the data?
So to start with the last question first, the best estimate that we have that's actually been published in terms of the amount of staff time required to do the surveillance, and this is the entire surveillance, not just this particular measure, is about 2 hours per month. So the facility, I believe this article was cited in the information that we submitted, but there's an article by George et al. In the British Medical Journal that described their experience doing the dialysis surveillance. They said after the a startup period, it required 2 hours of staff time per month to actually fully follow the protocol and do the surveillance. We've informally polled facilities that are doing the surveillance, and for the most part, they've agreed with that, with some exceptions. In terms of the states that have, mandated this and validation efforts, Colorado just recently started, so they intend to take some time to actually look at their data before they publicly report it, and they do have plans for a validation that is tied to a validation study that CDC is, has begun now as well. The primary purpose of CDC's validation study is to actually look at electronic data that exists at large dialysis organizations and how well they do at capturing bloodstream infections, and that the goal is to look at all bloodstream infections, understanding that there are going to be some that are not captured within that outpatient dialysis setting or within the laboratory data sets that are linked to a large dialysis organization laboratory. But then a secondary part of that, one of the sites for that validation study includes Colorado, where they have the mandate, and so they will also be able to compare these three sources of data, one being NHSN. These same dialysis facilities that are reporting to NHSN also have electronic data in the large dialysis organization databases, and then we will do a separate manual data abstraction looking at the actual records in the facilities to validate the data that are in both of those sources.
Let me suggest that if you're asking questions now or discussing that, this is you need this for clarification for your vote rather than to persuade others, because I think we're getting close to being able to vote. Robert?
Let me just mention, I practice in Colorado. It's a burden. It's a burden on Monday morning, the facility administrators with the LDOs start making the phone calls. And at least my estimation of observing the amount of time and effort put into this is more than 2 hours a month. I mean, I can tell you from firsthand experience.
But you are, as a clinician, don't you want to, you want to know when that patient comes back, this patient has septicemia and was hospitalized, and here's what happened in the hospital, right?
I'm not saying I don't want to know that. What I'm saying, I'm addressing how much time it takes. It is
right.
A burden on the staff.
Wouldn't it be okay that when the patient comes back and you get the discharge summary, then you enter it into the computer? Does it have to be real time that day?
I think what happens, Peter, is that when a patient doesn't show up, the process then begins. You know, where is the patient? Why are they there? And so they, because of the mandate, they start collecting that data so that they can report on it.
Wouldn't you be doing that anyway? Even if you weren't collecting this data for this measure, if a patient doesn't show up, you're not going to be doing the same thing? Or
again, the question was, what is the burden on the staff? Now it's an additional burden of patient admitted for congestive heart failure to patient admitted for sepsis. Did you get blood cultures? Do you have that result? So it's the layering that, because there's no data communication, it has to be done verbally on the phone.
Okay, so then just to remind you that the next measure will involve even more data burden. So that's why I was arguing in favor of this one, which would also position facilities to participate in the existing NHSN dialysis event module.
Okay, Myra?
One other thing in terms of the data burden, for those places, for those people that are in places where there's a huge ambulance diversion problem, on my Monday morning, the nurses have to call every hospital in the area, even though I sent them to the one that's 2 miles away. You know, it's a 50-50 shot. If they end up at that hospital, they could end up anywhere in the metro area, depending on the ambulance diversion problem.
But aren't you going to have to do that anyways? I mean, don't you want to find them?
I want to find them, but the issue is I don't always get the information until some social worker is calling me to say that I want to send this patient home. This is what happened. And the nurses may have expended a lot of effort trying to find this patient.
I mean, I 100% agree that's a problem. I just don't see what that has to do with this measure. I mean, it's a huge problem for clinical practice. It's a huge problem. And, you know, we need interoperable medical records, so the hospital is going to send you electronically everything you need to know that what happened in that hospitalization. I mean, that's the problem with our health, one of the problems of our healthcare system today. I just don't necessarily think that's a reflection and a reason that this measure should not be measured.
And just to remind you, Dr. Patel did confirm that it is not in this measure. There is nowhere in this measure an expectation that you do that.
Okay, Jerry?
Then. Not saying this is the best measure in the whole set to address what we're trying to accomplish here, but generally if somebody is admitted to the hospital, they have a positive blood culture, they're going to come out of the hospital on an antibiotic, that information is going to be communicated to us at the dialysis center. Just to say that's another way that we're going to be able to, just going to trigger our knowledge to add that to this data collection.
Yeah, I would argue that there's no requirement this is real time. You have to put it in 3 minutes after the culture report comes back. You can put it in a week later, and that's fine. You know, so why is the staff calling? They may be calling for other reasons, but they don't need to be calling to get blood culture reports. And I might add, just you mentioned if the patient's admitted for congestive heart failure, you wouldn't suspect bacteremia. That's not correct. You have to, you know, a patient can present with CHF due to bacteremia. So we have to be looking for blood cultures for any hospitalization, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Ruben.
I think it's more the reality, and maybe I live in a place that in my unit they go to 22 different facilities. You can put the data in when it comes to you. Many times the discharge summary will not tell you when that positive blood culture happened. Was it day one or day five at the hospital? We would have to ask a lot more questions. The staff will have to spend more time doing this. I was very supportive, and I'm still supportive of all the infection, because I mean that's really high on our radar, Don. And we have to do something. It's just this scenario of this first day of hospitalization. I understand the reason for it. It's just the reality of it.
I think we've heard enough about, you know, this is maybe a sizable fraction, maybe a small fraction, but, you know, perfect isn't necessary or required to improve quality or to report publicly.
Can you harmonize the data from the hospital and from the dialysis facility in Colorado? You'll know for a single patient where if they have a positive blood culture, irrespective of the location.
That's a question for Dr. Patel.
You mean, would we be able to tell whether the positive blood culture that occurred was in a hospital or in the outpatient dialysis facility?
Yeah, so can you put the data together from the two sources?
I don't know that we have a way of doing that right now. That's the only way that we can look at that is through one of these validation efforts where we're actually actively going and finding cases that occurred in hospitals and making sure that they were also identified by the outpatient dialysis facility.
Okay, thanks. So are we ready to vote? All right. Very good.
Okay, this is measure 1460, importance to measure and report. And keep in mind what these criteria are. I know we had a lot of discussion about feasibility, but that's on feasibility.
Oops,
Has everybody voted? Okay, we'll go.
We have 17 yes and 2 no.
Okay, we'll go to scientific acceptability of measure properties. Go ahead, start the timer. Wait until the timer is started. Four complete, 16 partially. Okay, next is usability. Wait till the timer starts. Six completely, 10 partially, 3 minimally, and 1 not at all. Okay. And before we vote on the measure, I should have said this at the very beginning, or reminded you, we have a lot of infection measures, and what we're doing right now is to see if each individually would meet the criteria. Once we get through that, we are going to definitely have to look at this set to determine if we've got duplicative measures. Is there a way to choose the best way to measure this in this population? So, again, we're evaluating each individually right now. So, next one is
feasibility.
Feasibility. One completely, 9 partially, and 9 minimally. Okay. And then finally, do you recommend the measure for endorsement? Go ahead.
You got 20.
Thirteen yes and 7 no.
Okay. We'd like to get one or two more done before lunch. What time is lunch at?
We'll do this last CDC measure, and then we will do, pardon me? Oh, two more CDC, I'm sorry. Okay, all right.
One more HSH, and let's do
Why don't we do that measure, then we'll have public comment, and then we'll break for lunch.
Okay, very good. So the next measure is 1478 NHSN, vascular access-related bloodstream infection measure. Sue.
So this is the number of hemodialysis outpatients with positive blood cultures and in whom the suspected source was reported either the vascular access or unknown, same denominator. From the preliminary evaluations, 2 voted in favor and 4 against. Just so you know, this is basically the very same measure with that one exception that we've already noted, which is that it attributes the infection to a vascular access. So the arguments in favor are all the same, that, you know, the existing database and data stream and testing and the arguments, and also that, you know, it gives you more information relative to vascular access related infections. Arguments against are all of those that we already heard as well. I don't think there are any additional arguments against, except that possibly this could be considered a greater data burden.
Okay.
Who and how is the determination made about, and how is this documented? Who makes the decision? How is it transmitted? All those sorts of things.
So, Dr. Patel?
So there is a question on the data entry form or the event report form that basically asks the suspected source of the positive blood culture, if there is a positive blood culture. We don't dictate who makes that determination, so it could be the nurse, it could be the physician, attending physician. But we simply ask that question of whoever is submitting that data, so we don't specify who should make that decision.
And is it specified? It just says in the numerator details, suspected source, so that's up to each individual organization to determine how they make that determination of what is the suspected source. Are there any guidelines for that?
The only guidance that we provide the same suggestions that are included in the BSI surveillance that's done on the inpatient side, particularly with respect to contaminants or common skin contaminants. So we provide a list of common skin contaminants, and we say that, you know, if you have a positive culture for some of these, consider whether it could be a contaminant. But really the rest of it is up to the person in the facility.
So just in summary, I would say that the reason I voted against this measure is only because I think it's really important to minimize data burden. And so one infection measure to me is sufficient. I voted against all the other measures as well for that reason, and in favor of NHSN as the gold standard for healthcare-associated infection reporting.
I think in this measure, again, leaves a lot to people wish list. If you have a catheter patient, you always are suspicious that a positive blood culture was a catheter. So you would say suspected, although you would pick the unknown. Catheter looks great on the outside, everything looks fine, and this measure does take away the diabetic with the foot ulcer, because that's eliminated from this, and that's good. But this suspicion versus unknown, it depends on the day of the week and who's making rounds and how fast they go. And I have a lot of concerns, even though, again, this is a very important measure.
Isn't it also kind of a bias to the evaluating physician to judge it not to be a vascular access infection? Is that a problem, possibly?
And just to add to this discussion, it is important to know who that person is and whether or not they could be one of a number of physicians at, as you said, 20 different hospitals that weigh in on that judgment and dictate a discharge summary. My specific question for Dr. Patel is, of all these positive blood cultures associated with vascular access, my suspicion would be there would be a high number of hospitalizations associated with this. What percent of the positive blood culture access related are hospitalized?
I do have that information. Unfortunately, I don't have it right in front of me. If there's a way for me, we're still on lockdown because of the ice storm, but if there's a way for me to get that to you later today or later this week, I could do that.
Thank you.
Yes, you can send that to us.
Okay,
send it to Lauren.
I just want to add that I've been adjudicating admissions for the Frequent Hemodialysis Network trial for the Outcomes Committee. It's so we are blinded to patient specific information, and we look at hospitalizations and data regarding positive blood culture for this very purpose, to determine if they're vascular access related or not. And even with the best minds and the best experts in the field, well-meaning, blinded to the individual, it's sometimes very difficult, even with a lot of information, to determine this. So even, you know, being blinded to the without even having any biases for the outcome or incentives for the outcome, it can be difficult. So that's a concern for me.
Thank you. Alan?
I guess what's interesting to me is that the measure still is not either one of these, the one that I think is of interest, which is that group of patients with catheters that have bloodstream infections. Not the judgment of the doctor if they were related, but simply presence of a catheter and bloodstream infection.
Well, if there's a catheter present, there will be a bloodstream infection sooner or later. Right.
But you would get that from the other, you would have that in the other measure because you have it stratified by the type of vascular access. So you, I mean that.
That's right. But I guess what I'm just focusing our attention as we rate these. That my own sense is that it's that cross referencing that it really is of most importance.
That's the patient population for which this is probably most actionable, right?
That's what this measure gives you without the complicated algorithmic definition that's required for the inpatient side. Would you add anything to that, Dr. Patel?
No, that's exactly right. So it does give you that, and we understand and realize that there's subjectivity and sort of this determination of whether it's access related or not, and that's the reason that we like to look at both the all BSI measure stratified by vascular access type as well as the vascular, you know, the BSIs that are determined to be vascular access related.
Other comments?
And a quick question is, the measure we just approved, what does this measure add that the other one doesn't already help them? Yeah, judgment, that's about it. Because the other one tells us if you have a catheter and...
That's why I voted against it and all the other measures as well. I think, in my opinion, we need one infection measure because there is a single source most frequently reported in this patient population.
So, I see nods. I'm ready to vote on everybody's face. Am I reading right? Okay.
Okay. This is measure 1478, and we'll start with importance to measure and report. Start and wait till the timer starts. Twelve yeses and one no.
Eight no.
I'm sorry, eight no. Okay. Next is scientific acceptability of measure properties. Let's wait till the timer starts. Two completely, 11 partially, and 7 minimally. Okay. Next is usability. Everyone finished? Okay, we can go ahead. Two completely, 9 partially, 7 minimally, 1 not at all. Okay. Next is feasibility. Let's start the timer. Eight partially, 10 minimally, 2 not at all. Okay, and finally, would you recommend this measure for endorsement?
Four yes and 16 no.
Okay, it's time to allow for public comment and also comments from the measure developers. Who would like to start? Anyone? Anyone on the phone?
As a reminder, that's star one for a comment over the telephone. We have no one over the telephone at this time, sir.
Thank you. All right, then I guess we're good to break for lunch. We're going to try to, we want to do a lunch like we did yesterday where we come back in 15 minutes and get moving again. I'd recommend that. If the committee could do that, I'd appreciate it. And so would Christine. Thank you very much.
So we'll try to reconvene at 12:15.